Okay, good afternoon, everyone. We're going to convene the TRPA Governing Board meeting for Wednesday, July 27th, 2022. It is now 12:26 p.m. And before we get started, I just want to announce to the public that we do intend to take a quick lunch break right before we get to item 7 on our agenda. So we'll try to get through items 1 through 6 and then take a quick lunch break. So I wanted to make that clear. And now I've given everybody time to sit down. Mario, will you call the roll?
Ms. Aldine.
Here.
Mr. Anderson. Ms. Conrad-Seda.
Here.
Ms. Diss. Ms. Faustinos.
Here.
Mr. Friedrich.
Here.
Ms. Gustafson.
Here.
Mr. Hicks. Ms. Hill.
Here.
Mr. Honigman.
Here.
Mr. Lawrence.
Here.
Ms. Novosel.
Here.
Mr. Rice.
Here.
Ms. Williamson.
Here.
Mr. Yates.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Maria. And before we go on, I wanted to take this opportunity to welcome our newest governing board member, Jessica Diss. And I asked Jessica if she would give us a brief introduction and put her on the spot for Sing this today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will admit I did write down some things so that I wouldn't forget. So I'm not quite polished yet, but thank you for giving me the opportunity to introduce myself. My name is Jessica Diss, and I was appointed to the governing board last month by Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak. And I want to start by thanking the TRPA leadership team and the other members of the board for the very warm welcome so far. And also want to thank Mark Bruce for all of his hard work and dedication to TRPA and to Nevada the last 9 years, 8 years. By way of a little bit of an introduction, I am an attorney by training, if not by practice, and I did work here at TRPA as an attorney in 2013-14. I had a different last name at the time, but then I moved on to state government, where I actually worked with Haley Williamson for 4 years at the Nevada Public Utilities Commission, and worked also in the governor's office, and then for about the past year, I've been in the private sector. I work in anti-bribery and anti-corruption compliance for a renewable energy company in Reno. And on the personal side of things, I'm from Reno originally. I've lived there most of my life, but I've also lived in Tennessee and Northern California and Washington, D.C. a little bit. I've been back in the Reno area for the last 10 years or so. I'm married. I have two little kids. And I think like everyone here, Lake Tahoe holds a very special place in my heart. I grew up recreating here with my family, and I still come up a lot. And I've had interactions with the basin and with the lake as a day tripper, as an overnight tourist, as one summer as a seasonal worker, and then working here a little bit at TRPA. So I'm just really honored and thrilled to be a part of this organization and to learn from all of you and get to know you and get to know all the stakeholders and collaborators and partner agencies. And thank you again for the warm welcome.
Thank you so much, Jessica. And we really appreciate having you here and welcome. I found out earlier while we were waiting for this meeting to get going that she spent a number of years renting a home right down the street from me with her family on summer vacations. So great to have you here. So I'm going to now go over the remote and in-person meeting rules for the day. For the members of the public who are joining us remotely to observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov. Under the calendar header, click on Governing Board Hybrid Meeting for July 27th, 2022. There you will find a link to the public webinar hosted on Zoom. To address board members directly with your comments, raise your hand in Zoom by clicking Raise Hand at the bottom of your screen at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the board. If you've used the dial-in numbers to join us by telephone, you can dial *9 to raise your hand and be unmuted. To our remote board members, if you wish to speak, please also raise your hand in Zoom. You will find the hand icon on the bottom of your screen. Remote board members may not use the chat box to make any comments or to have sidebar conversations. Please, everyone, remember to mute your mic unless speaking to cut down on background noise. Finally, I would also like to ask that all remote members turn on their cameras if they are able. Members of the public who have joined us in person, please raise your hand at the appropriate time for public comment and you will be called to the front to speak. And board members who are in person, please raise your hand if you wish to comment and speak clearly into the microphone in front of you. If you are viewing the webinar on a personal computer, please ensure that your microphone and speakers are turned off to prevent audio feedback into the room. It's a long list of items to get through. So thank you for bearing with me on that. And we'll go to our Pledge of Allegiance. Shelley, will you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We'll move on then to item number 3 on our agenda, approval of the agenda. Are there any staff changes to the agenda?
No, Madam Chair, there are no changes.
Are there any objections from the board? Otherwise, we're going to deem that the agenda is approved as indicated for the record. We are now on to agenda item 4, approval of the minutes, and we don't have minutes in our packet. We will have a set of minutes next month from the June 22nd, 2022, and we'll approve it at that time. So then we'll move on to item 5, the TRPA consent calendar. There is one item on consent which wasn't reviewed by any committee. And as a reminder to the public, after board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in person to be called on in Zoom to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So consent items number 1 is the Quagga Zebra Mussel Infestation Prevention Grant Program Application and Funding Agreement Resolution. Information on this item can be found on page 25. Are there any questions or comments from board members on these consent items? Yes. Yes, Shelley.
Suggested change. I apologize. Under the now, therefore, be it resolved, we probably need an add a 2 to including but not limited to, and then you have a kind of a list of items. 2 was omitted.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, Madam Chair, I move to approve the consent calendar.
Thank you, Shelley. Are there any public comments on the consent calendar?
Madam Chair, I see no hands raised to make public comment on this item.
So we'll close our public comments. We have the motion. Any further discussion from the board? Okay, Maria, will you call the roll?
Ms. Aldine?
Yes.
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Yes.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos?
Yes.
Ms. Diss?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Madam Chair, the motion passes.
Thank you, Maria. We'll move on then to item number 6, administrative matters. And that takes us to 6A, the election of the governing board chair and vice chair for the remainder of 2022 and for the 2023-2024 term. Information on this item can be found on page 27 of our packet. And as a reminder to the public, after the staff presentation and board discussion, you may raise your hand in person to be called on or in Zoom webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So with that, I can ask if there are nominations. We can either do this as one motion for both positions or we can do each. And Jim has his hand raised, so I'll call on Jim.
Thank you. And
You know, I know it's been a long morning and we still have a lot of work to do. So I would propose just do it as one nomination, if that's okay with everybody. And, you know, thankful that folks will do this. This is going to be a longer term. So I nominate because I highly value these folks. I think it'd be great. But it's not a punishment. I would nominate Cindy Gustafson as chair and then Haley Williamson as vice chair.
Thank you, Jim. Any discussion on that item? Any comments? I'm not seeing any. So, Maria,
can't get out.
Before we call for a vote, is there any public comment on this item?
Madam Chair, I don't see any hands raised to make public comment on this item.
Okay, thank you, Maria. Then we'll ask you to call the roll.
I'm sorry, that was what Jim did, was to nominate if somebody wants to make a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Make a motion to elect Cindy as chair and Haley Williamson as vice chair.
Just to clarify, that motion covers two different periods, one for the remainder of the term for 2021-2022, and then for the succeeding 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you for the clarifications, and thanks for catching me on my shortcutting that item. Okay, Maria, will you call the roll?
Ms. Conrad Seda?
Yes.
Ms. Aldine?
Yes.
Ms. Faustinos?
Yes.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Friedrich?
Yes.
Ms. Diss?
Yes.
Mr. Honigman?
Yes.
Ms. Hill?
Enthusiastically, yes.
Ms. Novosel?
Yes.
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Mr. Yates?
Yes.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Ms. Williamson?
Yes.
Ms. Gustafson?
Yes.
Madam Chair, the motion passes.
And I was less than enthusiastic, but I... Thanks, Alexis. Thank you. I appreciate your support, and hope I can do as well as the previous chairs have done on this board. Then we'll move on to item 6B, and this is the Ad Hoc Executive Director Search Committee report. This morning, we did meet, and Shelley can give us a report on this.
I see Sonia Brockman has joined us.
Okay.
I'm still waiting for Steve, who's probably logging on as we speak. Thank you, Cindy. Yes, the Ad Hoc Executive Director Search Committee met earlier this morning and received a report, status report from our folks at Prothman. And Angela, if you want to introduce them formally, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Sure. Great, thank you. For the record, Angela Atchley, Director of Human Resources for TRPA. We chose Prothman as the recruitment firm to handle the executive director recruitment. And we have Sonia Prothman and Steve Worthington on the Zoom call here today to answer any questions. And they provided some information to us on the status of their recruitment at the ad hoc committee meeting earlier this morning. So welcome Sonia and Steve to the governing board today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
So, as indicated, we did meet. I'm assuming that every member of the board has been contacted by Prothman and interviewed. And I thank you for participating in those interviews. It's extremely important that we all play a role because this decision is going to be, will in many ways determine the future of this organization going forward for the next number of years. In addition to that, a number of staff members were interviewed, members of APC, and 18 members from various stakeholder organizations. The feedback will be used, obviously, in the screening process of candidates. And correct me if I'm wrong, I will defer to Steve and later in this presentation, but I believe that the feedback from those interviews will be made available to Angela later today. I think that was the intent And then the position will be posted online on Monday. And the recruitment window is 5 weeks. Hopefully that won't have to be modified. Hopefully we get you know, a plethora of people applying for the position. But if you do have names of people that you know who you think would be qualified for the position, please don't hesitate to contact Angela, and Angela will act as our go-between with the Prothman organization. So with that, Sonia, Steve, I don't know who wants to lead off, but if you could kind of quickly summarize our discussion and some of the decisions that we have kind of tentatively made as a committee from a meeting earlier today, that would be great.
Wonderful. Thank you again for the opportunity. You've done a great job of summary, and indeed we've done our outreach. I've just completed my review of the profile draft, and that'll be on its way to Angela later today. And that profile is a key piece of what we get to work with and how we get people's attention. It's an effective tool, and all of your participation has been great to help refine that. So I appreciate your willingness to connect. We have had quite a bit of input on this, which has been very helpful. We talked also about schedule, and I think that Angela has that information for your discussion today. Regrettably, as it turns out, I have a conflicting appointment that I'll need to leave for in a few minutes. It's scheduled that some months ago. But in any case, I do appreciate the opportunity to work with you, and we'll be able to pick up our discussion from that. Sonia?
Hello, everybody. Nice to meet everybody. We're really looking forward to helping you guys find your great next executive director. So this is a Tahoe. That whole area is beautiful. I just flew over it the other day. I flew into the John Wayne, and it goes right over the lake. So that's interesting. I hadn't flown into John Wayne Airport before and had that view. It's amazing view. So anyway, we're very excited to be helping you. The process is going to be moving forward. Once we post, there's not going to be a lot of information coming out. It's going to be a 5-week recruitment window. Most of the people that apply usually the last weekend. So you'll be getting updates, but you're not going to be getting, oh yeah, we've got 40 applications in a week. That doesn't happen. So just make sure that the expectations are there for that. We're going to be busy once we post. We're very, very busy on our end. And things you don't see is all the advertising we're placing, the direct mail campaign we're going to be doing to place a job announcement on people's desks, emails. We back up with emails, several emails, networking, getting names from any of you, of people that you know in the industry that you want us to contact. All that kind of stuff is going to be happening prior to the next time you probably hear from us. So just to let you know on that. So that's about it.
I know that we haven't made a final decision with respect to the stakeholder panel interviews in terms of calendaring those and the governing board interviews. But Sonia, would you like to kind of summarize what we discussed during today's meeting regarding the pros and cons of dividing this process into 2 days. And I want to make sure that every governing board member, when you received your original calendar of meetings, you were asked to reserve the fourth Thursday of every month as well as a possible meeting day for TRPA if we couldn't conclude our business on one day. I would ask that you make certain that that's the case, that you're available in October, both the fourth Wednesday and Thursday of that month. Because it appears that portions of the process will be calendared over both of those days. So I don't know if you wanted to add anything, Sonia, or just deem it still a work in progress with respect to this.
I think that those kind of decisions and stuff is still in progress. I don't know how much to add here, to complicate it. You know, our process, we typically do a reception the evening before the interviews and then do the interviews the next day. It's been brought up to maybe have the interviews with all the stakeholder panels, staff and community or, you know, organization stakeholder panels the day before so that the board can watch. That's not typically part of our process. We've done, you know, 400 of these recruitments. And so I mentioned earlier, you know, to see what your goal is for doing that, you know, in the the candidates will know they're being watched, so their interviews with the panels might be different. So you might not be getting the feedback that you are looking for from your panels, because the interview might be different. So something to think about.
To summarize, I guess the process will be further refined, and you will be notified of a final schedule for the interviews. I wouldn't discourage people necessarily from participating as as a member of the audience during the stakeholder interviews, but it won't be mandatory because there will be facilitation. And as I understand it, the results of the stakeholder panel interviews will be memorialized in writing and provided to every member of the board. So more to come. And I also wanted to just note that Vince is the co-chair of the ad hoc committee. So glad to be working with him to bring this process to a happy conclusion. Since we have both Steve is still with us, and we have Sonia, are there any questions by members of the governing board? Yes, Ashley.
I just had a question about the recruiting timeline. I've heard that with a lot of searches lately, the labor market is not flooded with applicants, and that they're seeing response times on job listings take longer than expected. And just thinking about listing this in the month of August when folks are still in summer mode, I'm wondering if we could list it for longer, give it like August and September to list it if possible, or just do it longer than 5 weeks if four of those 5 weeks are fully in August. Because I just want to make sure we have, you know, enough time to do outreach and get people who are finishing up their summers, if they're interested, to apply for the position. So that's just my one concern, is the listing timeframe overlapping with summer. And also that I've heard that some of these recruiting processes have been listed more than once, even for these high level positions, because there's a lot of jobs and not a lot of people to fill them right now.
Yes, and if I may, thank you. We do see some listings that need to be repeated. That does happen in the current labor market. This listing actually runs a little bit longer than 5 weeks. The first review date is September 11th. We start the advertising. We're scheduled to start on Monday. And so you actually do get into September a bit. I have about 2 weeks to interview screen candidates and then write a report. And I meet with the ad hoc committee on the 28th of September. To deliver that report and have them identify who they believe they would like to have for final interviews. And those interviews, as was mentioned earlier, we're scheduling those, or at least targeting the 26th and 27th of October. It'll be most likely a two-day process by the time between one event or another. And there's actually about four different touch points that the board and representatives have to provide feedback to you. So I'm sorry about my schedule, but I'm afraid I will have to ring off now. But I hope that was helpful information for you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Was that helpful, Angela?
Ashley, yeah.
Ashley.
No, no worries. Yes, no, that's helpful. It's just more, you know, I just want to have us be eyes wide open about the labor market right now and you know, the ability to make sure that we have ample time to recruit folks.
You know, I think if we get no applicants, we'll by necessity have to extend the application period. So I think we need to remain nimble
Absolutely.
And flexible going forward. So we still have Sonia, however, with us. So any other questions by members of the governing board that she can answer? I have to say that having been a part of the group that reviewed the companies that had expressed an interest in being hired by the agency to provide these services, that in my estimation, at least, Prothman was clearly the most qualified. So I'm looking forward to working with them, and I'm very confident we'll have a very successful outcome. So, okay. Madam Chair, I'll hand the meeting back to you.
Great. Thank you. Well, this was not for any action item. It was informational only, but are there any public comments on this item?
Madam Chair, there are no hands raised for public comment.
Okay, great. Then we'll close out on this. And then our discussion was to take a break now to have lunch. About how long do you think? I'd just like to give the public a heads up and our board members that are online waiting patiently for us, Belinda and Alexis.
I would suggest we reconvene at 1:15.
Okay. Does that sound acceptable? Okay. Well, then we'll reconvene at 1:15. Thank you. Okay. We told everybody we'd be back at 1:15. We're a few minutes after that. Apologize, but I think everybody needed a lunch break and got some great food. Thank you. So we're going to now move on to item 8 on our governing board agenda. This is an appeal. Item 7A, the appeal of the condition of approval for reconstruction expansion of an existing pier at 1590 North Lake Tahoe Boulevard, Placer County, California, assessor's parcel APN 094-160-008, TRPA file number ERSP 2020-2095, appeal number admin 2022-0014. Information on this item can be found on page 29. And as a reminder to the public, after staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in person to be called on or in the Zoom webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. So now I'm going to pass it over to our chair of our legal committee today, Sue Novosel.
Thank you, Chairman Gustafson. With that, we did meet this morning, the legal committee, and had a very long conversation. I apologize for the length, but it was very good. And I think what I'm going to do is go ahead and defer this over to John Marshall, our counsel, who can describe a little better what our discussions were. Thank you, John.
So I'll just give a quick review, and then we'll go into the normal presentation. But the committee unanimously recommended that you deny the appeal. When we get to the motion part of that, we'll talk about how that happens. But the committee had, I think we had a good discussion about all the issues, good colloquy with the applicant as well. And we're going to present you with a skinny down version of those basic issues. So I think we're ready. I'll just roll into the staff presentation. So if we could have the first slide, please. So again, this is just a site map. This is, we're on the North Shore. And we are, that the arrow is showing the existing pier structure. So, what they have is they have a pier, which as you saw in the staff report, is defined as, all that structure from basically the high water mark out into the lake that reaches a certain depth and serves a certain function. We're not really here concerned about this is a pier. We recognize this as a pier. It is non-conforming for a number of reasons, as we discussed earlier. Can you go to the next slide, please? This is the view of the structure from the lake. From the end of the pier looking up towards the house, you'll see that there is a walkway up to a stairway that leads up to the boulder. The boulder then houses the walkway back towards house. It has, as part of the walkway, a kind of bump out sun deck. If you could go to the next slide. This is the view in the opposite direction where you are looking from the walkway out onto the sun deck, and then you can see the stairs descending down, and then down below is the section that is supported by piles and that functionally serves as the place to moor and board boats, etc. Next slide, please. So again, what this slide represents is the as-built condition. The red line that you see on there that we've enhanced with the color is the high water mark. And so what we're really discussing is what happens to the remainder of the pier that is left after we go through the rebuild. Let's go to the next slide, please. So this is what the first application that came in. Was you can see that they're underneath on the left hand, you'll see the boulder that has the sun deck on it, and then the stairs down to the part that functions as a pier. The short underlying piece is the existing structure, and this was the original expansion that they wanted, that they came in with the original proposal. Now, the pier itself, the existing pier, is non-conforming. It's nonconforming because it has structure on a boulder. It has a sun deck in the shore zone. And as we clarified this morning, it has a series of stairs that are overlong under today's design standards to get down to the pier deck. Under our rules, one cannot expand a nonconforming structure in the shore zone. The only way you can get an expansion is if you bring the pier structure into conformance, and then you can expand. So what they were proposing to do was just to essentially take out the short section of the lakeward side of the pier and then expand it out into a new walkway, pier head, and put a boat lift on that. Now, since you can't expand a non-conforming structure, this was not acceptable. We couldn't make the findings for this pier. So we worked with the applicant. Can we go to the next slide, please? This was the proposal to essentially move the pier northward a bit and hook into the old walk or the existing walkway right about at high water. In order to make the findings to approve this pier, TRPA concluded that the remainder of the old pier had to be removed from that red line lakeward. So that includes the walkway and the deck bump out, and as well as the stairs and the old structure that was more at lake level. So that's the condition that is being contested here, is the condition to remove all that non-conforming structure of the of what fits in within the TRPA definition of a pier. We go to the next slide, please. I think that's it. So we're going to stop here. And the key issue we discussed is there something that in the application that would kick this out of the normal rules, essentially? And TRPA staff position is that this is just like any other expansion of non-conforming structure. You have to remove or bring the structure into conformance in order to get the expansion. You can't have it both ways. You can keep the non-conforming structure, or you can bring it into conformance and expand it, but you can't do both. And that's what the applicant is requesting here, to get rid of the condition that essentially allowed, that required them to remove the walkway and the non-conforming structures. And so that really was what the legal committee then decided to affirm that staff position and recommend to you to deny the appeal. We talked a bit about the legality of various documents that you may hear from the applicants when they came up, or the effect of various TRPA site assessments that had the label of pier and deck separately. I emphasize that those site assessments are not the purpose of those site assessments are for coverage purposes, not for the verification of shore zone structures. And so we don't even look at what is labeled on the pier or those labels that were submitted by the applicant for that site assessment. We're not verifying those in the context of a site assessment. So those were not prior determinations by TRPA that these were two different structures. So there, I think the thrust of their argument is they should be treated differently here. The pier, that what they call the pier, which is the kind of lakeward section from the stairs down, and then the landward section of the path out to the boulder, and then the pathway and the deck bump out that they would like to keep. And we talked a little bit about the precedential nature on both sides of this. They argued that there's a danger of being TRPA staff being able to reach further landward of the structure and affect other non-conforming structures. I think staff's position is that's not possible, because what's really happening here is bringing the pier into conformance, not other structures. So the pier has to be in conformance, and the definition of the pier is set in TRPA code. So that limits TRPA's discretion. We think that if this appeal is granted, what we're going to be seeing is a lot of applications to try to differentiate parts of peers that are non-conforming that they want to retain and claim that they can then use the remaining structure of the pier as the conforming part and expand that. So we see kind of a mischief being possible with what the applicants are deciding. So I'm going to turn it over now to the applicant. That's our presentation. Then we'll have time for wrap up and then questions.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, honorable members of the board. My name is Greg Gatto, and I am here with our TRPA consultant, Wyatt Ogilvy, on behalf of the applicant in this matter, Rob Adelman. John, thank you for that presentation. I will also try to skinny my presentation down, but I'm not very good at skinning things down, so we will work our best here. I think John covered a lot of the salient points. There was a, what I want to start with is really the discussion that we had during the legal committee, and I think there were some good questions that were brought up. Primarily, I think Mr. Yates raised a prior application that was brought before TRPA involving the former Ty Cobb deck and pier. I think that was the Poe pier slash deck. And really what came out of that discussion many years ago was this definition that TRPA looks at a pier now that focuses on the utility or the function of the structure. And that definition says that a pier has to be intended as a landing or temporary mooring. And the question we have for the governing board today is whether that deck that you see on top of the boulder, which was separately permitted and constructed from the appurtenance that actually extends into the water, was ever intended as a landing or temporary mooring, as a pier. And I think that we can agree that but for that common stairway that leads down from that deck, if that stairway did not exist and there wasn't a common access way between the pier and the deck, that deck would be allowed to remain as a separate legal non-conforming structure. So the question really is, are these two structures or is it a common structure merely because there is a common access way or a common stairway? Next slide, please. And so the appeal today is solely from condition of approval 3B6, which requires that all existing structures lakeward of the high water line be removed as a result of the project. Next slide. So here we see the subject of this condition. It's the sun deck. The sun deck is at an elevation of approximately 6239. And as you can see, the sun deck was never intended as a landing or a mooring, nor can it function as a landing or a mooring. Next slide. So again, the threshold question, I think, for the governing board is, you know, does a separately permitted and separately legally recognized structure that is attached by a common walkway become a pier by the mere fact that it is attached? Next slide. I think as John referenced, there's been several regulatory agencies that have recognized the sun deck as a separate structure from the pier. Now, while they are working under a different definition than TRPA has from a pier, they actually recognized this was a separate structure. It wasn't a part of the pier. Next slide. This is the original building permit application for the sun deck submitted in June of 1960. The application is to construct a walk, the sun deck, and the stairs, and it does not include the construction of the pier. Again, this goes to the intent of the original construction of this project. This sun deck was not intended as a landing or a mooring. Next slide. These are the assessor building records from Placer County, again, recognizing the sun deck as a separate structure from the pier. Separate and apart, it was constructed separately from the pier. Next slide. These are the TRPA site assessments that Mr. Marshall referred to. Again, while they're not binding on TRPA, this shows that the applicant at the time, this was a 2019 and 2015 site assessment, considered these structures to be separate. This is not something that this applicant, the current owner, has recently thought up to try to segment this pier into two separate parts in order to be able to retain the deck. The deck was always considered a separate structure from the pier. Next slide. This is a California State Lands Commission lease. Again, there was some discussion about this during the legal committee. While the state lands does not include the deck as part of their lease, they do evaluate structures that are below the low water, that are between the high water line and the low water line for the public trust. And they created this exhibit showing the deck as a separate structure from the pier. Next line. Next slide. This is the 2018 MLS listing. Prior to the current owner's purchase of the property, it advertised the sun deck as separate and additional from the pier. Again, showing that the intent was that these were two separate structures. Next slide, please. So I think, you know, to try to wrap this up quickly, if the pier were to be destroyed and it was not rebuilt in, I think, the 3 years for the time to be serviceable, we'd be able to maintain this structure. This structure would be a separate legal non-conforming structure. I think also looking at the Poe case where you have what someone argued to be a pier was a deck. And the inverse kind of relationship there, that this is the intent here for this separate structure was never to be served as a pier. And the mere fact that there is a common access way should not join those two structures and require the removal of a separate legal nonconforming structure by virtue of the modification of the pier. And I think that's all I have. Thank you for your consideration, and Wyatt and I are both available for any questions.
I was just going to give a quick wrap up and then turn it back over for questions. So you can really see, I think, where the difference of opinion here is and what this structure is. TRPA defines that entire structure as the pier. And if you want to expand to bring all your pier into conformance, and in this case, move it to a slightly different location, you need to remove the old pier. And that's basically what we feel the perspective is here. That what they're trying to do is maintain segments of that old structure, the non-conforming segments, and get their cake too and expand the structure to serve how they want. They have a choice to either keep the structure as is, a non-legally non-conforming structure, or they can expand it. And if they do, they have to bring it all into conformance. That's our basic, I think, staff's basic position here. I think that's kind of it. For our purposes, and we can talk about any of the particulars about any of the issues that you feel you have questions for.
Okay. Thank you, John. Appreciate that. Board members, any questions? Yes, Ashley.
I just had a question about the comment you made, John, about the sort of precedential aspects of this decision, right? That there's a number of non-conforming peers that would all, that if we allowed this, then all these other non-conforming peers would pursue the same sort of decision. But I guess my question is, what's the environmental impact of removing all of those non-conforming peers over time and building all new peers? And has that been discussed, considered, right, in the broader sort of longer term vision for implications or applications of this policy?
Yes, in our environmental work for the adoption of the shoreline plan, we looked at how, you know, all these new ordinances, which include, you know, the ability to build a pier like this. You know, we essentially, one of the concepts was if you're going to be moving towards non-conforming structures, which essentially is what our regional plan, we have policies that direct us to do that. Is if we lose those opportunities, and all we're doing is just, you know, allowing non-conforming structures to remain, that changes the assumptions that we're into, basically into that environmental document, because it presumed that we're going to get some gain, from the removal of non-conforming structures. In this case, we're generally talking about scenic values. you know, this is not really so much a water quality question, but is it, you know, we can control heavily the use within the shore zone and also visible structure. Those are the two things that make this pier nonconforming essentially. And so we'd be losing the benefit gained around the lake, you know, in a cumulative sense. And we'd be, at the same time, we'd be allowing the expansion, which has additional scenic impact associated with it. So we wouldn't be getting that as much of that trade-off. So that I think is the key answer.
Are there other questions or comments? Alexis or Belinda, did you have any questions?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
None for me either. Thank you.
Thank you both. I being relatively new, not the newest anymore, or you know, there's a few after me, but I wanted to find out more about the Poe case because that's been referenced several times, and I'm not familiar with that one. So
what that appeal had to do with is this question of utility of a pier. This came before the board prior to the 2018 adoption of the shoreline plan. Mm-hmm. And this has to do with our old definition, which was if you had a structure that extended over high water, it was, you know, you could argue it is included as a pier, even though it couldn't function as a pier. This was just a deck laying on the beach. So this doesn't really have to do with the conforming, non-conforming issue, but whether or not you met the definition of a pier. And in that case, the applicant was saying, well, we have cleats on on this deck that's sitting on the ground, and you can lash onto it, so therefore it would function as a pier.
Oh, I see.
And in part, that case was the justification for changing our definition of a pier to include not only length over, you know, extending over high water by a certain amount, but also this utility and functionality requirement that. I think we talked with Haley in particular at legal committee about. And so that case really centered on this notion that if you just had the deck that they're talking about on top of the buoy, that wouldn't qualify as a pier because you couldn't, you know, didn't service a kind of lakefront use for boating, essentially.
Okay.
So that didn't have to do with this kind of issue of bringing the pier structure into conformance. If it was a non-conforming structure.
Okay. A lot of nuances in the definition of a pier and structures. Obviously, if there's other structures between high water and the lake, or you know, within that area, there are other types of structures that could be out there. And isn't our intent in the shore zone policy to limit that and to try to get better back into conformance with all the structures?
Yes, but with one important caveat. If they had another structure that extended out that was non-conforming, mm-hmm. you know, extended out, maybe let's say another actual sun deck with its own pier walkway to someplace else on the property, and they just wanted to deal with this one, we wouldn't be going to that other structure and say, you need to remove that also.
Okay.
You know, if they wanted to remove it for, let's say, to claim scenic credit or offset some of the scenic impacts, then they could do that.
Separate.
If it was completely separate, we wouldn't be touching it.
Interesting. Okay. Yes, Shelley.
So, Don, I understand, you know, that a portion of this sun deck is, you know, integral to the pier as a whole. Because obviously you can't get from the end of the pier to the shore without crossing over a portion of that sun deck. This is kind of splitting hairs. Would it be possible to maintain half of that sun deck? Some portion of the sun deck that is not being used as a walkway to the shore?
That would result in a further nonconformance, you know? That's not how we have been interpreting and applying bringing the pier into conformance. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I think that hair
wouldn't split.
Is too thin to split.
Okay. Looking for compromise, always looking for compromise. Thank you.
Yes, Bill.
Yeah, essentially Mr. Gatto raised the point I raised as if you really think about it, just set it aside from our peer situation, and say you added a bedroom to your house, is it now two structures? No. Or if you added a garage or stuff like that, it's all part of the house. So however the property owner started with his peer project, he may have just started up to the Sunday, but he continued it out. So what you saw was an existing pier. And they want to expand that pier. Even if they just put they had a boat lift on that non-conforming pier, that's an expansion. That'd require, you know, bringing it into conformity. So they're building a much longer, a much better probably pier going out farther than the one now with a boat lift. And so that requires the replacement or taking down the non-conforming pier. And what they're asking is, well, let us just take it back. Like what Shelley was almost saying, let's just take it back and leave the sun deck there, that part of the house that we have. It was built out as a pier and needs to be removed so that you have the benefit that you want of your new pier. And I think that, that's really a choice that we discussed in legal committee. They could keep it, you know, if the sun deck is so important with the rest of the thing, they can keep their existing non-conforming pier. But if you want to meet our new standards, they got to get rid of the old pier. I think the precedent is much worse if we just left a bunch of different piers out there as a result of getting a brand new pier. So I think that's at least where I ended up on the issue. I was trying also to a certain extent, maybe just to the deck, but it is in fact, that whole structure has been built as a pier. How it was segmented to get to that point is still a pier. So.
So, John, just clarify something for me. The provision that they're contesting here, which is what is 3B6, was that not discussed with the applicant?
Yes.
It was discussed.
Yes.
So it was verbal, but they shouldn't have been surprised to see that it was a condition contained in the permit.
Correct. No, they knew there was going to be a condition for
permit. Okay.
Because that was the issue that was keeping the existing pier from being conforming to begin with.
Correct.
Was that sun deck. So trying to build a second pier was
another
way around that issue.
Yes.
What were the other non-conformances?
Stairway.
The stairway. Okay.
And don't we require, is it optional or do we require single piles?
Is Tiffany on? Yeah, there she is. Could you answer that question? Is it non-conforming because it has double piles now?
It's non-conforming for a few reasons. It extends into the side setback, the projection, the property boundary projection. Also, the deck height for piers is limited to, at the very maximum, an elevation of 6234. And the elevation of the deck up where the boulder, the deck portion on the pier that extends back to the upland, I think is at an elevation of 6239. So it extends that pier deck elevation. And that pier deck elevation is in place and a requirement primarily for scenic purposes. So the fact that it extends so much higher up, you can see the scenic impact of that. So those are the primary non-conformance issues.
Plus the deck is no longer allowed as a use within the shore zone, right?
Correct. Tiffany? Correct. It's not a permissible structure.
Okay. Any other board member questions? Okay, then we'll go to the public now. And it looked like Wyatt was up here. If you wish to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now, either in person or by clicking the raise hand button at the bottom of your Zoom screen, or by dialing *9 on your phone, and you will be called on and unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Maria, do we have members of the public on Zoom?
Madam Chair, we'll give it just one moment here. If anybody wants to raise their hand and make comment on this item, click the raise hand button. And it looks like we have no public comment on this item.
Okay, then those in the audience, Wyatt, did you want to speak to this?
There it is. Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to speak to a couple points of clarification, just because I know Mr. Adelman, if he was here, given the dialogue that we've had over time, would want me to make. And first of all,
Wyatt, will you introduce yourself? I know
sorry,
who you are.
My name is Wyatt Ogilvie. I'm a land use consultant and working with Greg in representation of Mr. Adelman. Related to the condition, when we first made the modification, for clarity, the staircase leading down from the boulder and the elevation is what we discussed initially in the relocation. And given staff workloads, the amount of work in the system, obviously project review has expanded considerably. I think our permit was issued something like 14 months after the date of submittal. And so this issue actually came up very late in the discussion of the condition. And given the duration of time, it was decided that we would go ahead and accept the condition and continue dialogue with staff and our interpretation, just for clarification.
I think accept the permit, but contest the condition. I think that's what you mean.
Oh, did I say, yeah, contest the condition solely, or we'll really talk about an interpretation with staff, which we did, that led to today's discussion and meeting in more detail. I wanted to address the scenic impact element, in as much that the retention of the sun deck would still require mitigation to bring it into compliance with current standards. And so whether or not the deck is viewed separate from the pier structure would still require scenic mitigation, bringing the parcel into compliance with visual mass for the property. And that's my interpretation, but I'd look to staff to clarify that. And then lastly, I think the heart of the argument is really this utility and function of a pier that's been deliberated, and whether the sun deck is part and parcel to the pier or a separate component. And from that function, I think that one has to look at it. I look at it from a bit different perspective than staff. And that is that if the appendage that leaves the boulder was never built, or if it were destroyed, you would only have the sun deck. And with the sun deck and its elevation on top of the boulder, one would not have the ability to moor or land a boat. And in that case, I would look to staff, but I think if you look at the sun deck in its isolation, it would not meet the definition of a pier structure. And so the inverse is that you only have the sun deck, would you qualify to expand the pier? And I believe the answer is no. And I find it, further to, I appreciate John's point of a separate deck structure elsewhere in the shore zone. If we had a smaller pier, if this pier were located where it is proposed today and the sun deck existed, and it would not require removal of the sun deck. They were constructed under separate permits with separate intent in a time prior to the creation of the agency. And I think that in part, the project, the project still requires compliance for all other standards, including water quality and scenic. And so I think that utility piece of, is it a pier alone as a sun deck, and it wouldn't qualify for expansion. So on one side, it's not a pier, but then on the other side, seeking expansion, the entirety is a pier. And for us, there's a inconsistency there. So I thank you for your consideration and your time today.
Thank you. Any other public comments on this item? Okay, then I'm going to close the public comment period, and we'll come back to board deliberation. Vince? Yes, sorry.
I just had a question. When you were allowing the expansion of the pier, when we were allowing the expansion of the pier, was the total scenic degradation or the total coverage or anything like that of taken into account? Like if we had allowed this deck to stay, would it have been a smaller pier that they were allowed to build? You know, because we're talking about the impacts on scenic quality. So were we considering the whole thing as one, and we wouldn't have allowed this pier extension that they want had we thought that we were going to also allow this deck to stay? Is that kind of how it works? I'm not sure.
I'm going to take a first stab and then turn it over to Tiffany to talk about specific mitigations. But we would not, we wouldn't have allowed the permit without removing the structure. So that's why the condition's there. And so, but what I want to clarify with Tiffany is that an existing structure doesn't need to be mitigated in and of itself. There's a separate shorelands scenic rating that you have to take into account when you bring in, when you do a project. If in general you meet that with all your existing structure, then they may or may not, it's their choice to use some of that structure to mitigate you know, the new structure that's allowed by the new pier. That's what they're trying to offset. And they can do that in a variety of ways. That doesn't have to occur on the pier structure. They can use other structure or other screening to accomplish that. Tiffany, do you want to add anything to that?
No, just to reiterate your first point that because we wouldn't have issued the permit and allow that deck structure to remain, that, you know, we didn't look at that in the review. The review was to remove the entire deck structure and look at the new, the existing pier structure and look at the proposed pier and ensure that the proposed pier is mitigated accordingly and that the property as a whole is in conformance.
So we would have to redo that analysis with the, you know, if in fact you make a determination that, you know, the appeal should be granted, then we'd have to go back and look and see whether or not, because we counted and some, you know, the total pier structure, including the sun deck, as their existing impact. And then we compare that to the new pier to see if that offsets or do they need to mitigate more or something like that. So most likely they would have to, either if they had extra, then they maybe could keep the sun deck, or they needed to mitigate more, they'd have to come up with some additional mitigation. Tiffany, just to confirm that. Okay.
Yep, that sounds appropriate.
Okay. Bill? No other questions? Yes, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's, you know, I guess from my thought, I certainly understand the applicant's argument and perspective, you know, and where they're coming from and wanting and desiring and maybe, you know, viewing this as two separate structures. It's been my experience, you know, particularly with non-conforming structures, you know, albeit my experience is more on the Nevada side than the California side, but there are a number of non-conforming structures on steeper slopes of which they have stairs as access. And I know in my time, I kind of looked at these things as Bill did. It's a kind of one big structure, you know, whether you call a portion of the stairs that might have a bit bigger landing on it, a deck or whatever, but it was all kind of one structure. And my concern is if, you know, if granting the applicant's appeal and trying to bifurcate these things into two different structures, if we have situations along the lake where you do have stairs going down and occasionally it widens out more than a stairway and, you know, they might put landing on their plan, but it's still really the stairs and the access to the pier. And so if we go down this path, then basically the next application that comes down the road that might have a non-conforming access stairway in the back shore, we want to get that rectified because the back shore and that's all part of the structure. But if we go down this, then there's the possibility that we'll have a lot of two stairways going down from properties down to Lake Tahoe where they bifurcated and one stairway goes partway down and they keep their landing and then they build their pier over here. And I think, no pun intended, but I think that's a bit of a slippery slope. And that's kind of where I'm coming from as well. And, you know, I kind of do look at it as Bill does. This is, you know, albeit it's a It's a very unusual construction. I've seen a lot of innovative constructions that are old and nonconforming around Lake Tahoe, believe me. And it does seem like, though, over the years, this has become one pier, and it does seem like one structure.
Thank you, Jim. Sue?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point because when the applicant was talking about, you know, gee, if you were to take the two structures and separate them out somehow, that you could do that. You could have an area where you would have the deck and an area where you have the pier. Well, in my mind, I think you can't have half a pier. You know, you've got to have a way to get down to that extension on that pier beyond where the deck is. And that's what I think makes it to me one structure, is you've got to use right now that area that they're using as a deck. That's partly the pier area also. That is your access to getting down to the water to get to your boat. So in that was kind of my way of thinking, was that is one structure then, because you have to have that. You can't have that pier out there without the stairs to get to it. So that's where I went. And we just want to make that clear in all that conversation. We had a lot of conversation about it. How do you consider that part of the deck? Well, in my mind, if you have to have it as access, then that obviously is a part of the structure. So that's where I landed with that. I just wanted to put that in there. And we did have a really good discussion, a long discussion. Thank you.
Any others? I'm not seeing any. Okay, well then I would entertain a motion from the board. And John, you wanted to go over the procedures on this one?
Yeah, this is, do we have the motion that's in the packet? Oh, I'm sorry, this is the motion, right? Forgive me. So the motion needs to be framed in the positive. So the motion is to grant the appeal. If you want to actually deny, then to deny the appeal and to affirm the executive director's decision, you vote no. If you want to overturn the executive director's decision, you vote yes. So I'm sorry to put you in this position, but we have it with all appeals. It needs to be an affirmative motion. And for this, in order for the motion to pass, it's like a normal project vote for California. So you would need 5 Californians and 9 overall to vote yes on this motion. But if you want to affirm the executive director and deny the appeal, then vote no.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move to grant the appeal.
Okay, thank you, Shelley. With that, Mario, if there's no questions, we'll ask Mario to call the vote.
Ms. Aldine?
No.
Ms. Conrad-Seda?
No.
Mr. Anderson?
No.
Ms. Faustinos?
No.
Ms. Diss?
No.
Mr. Friedrich?
No.
Ms. Hill?
No.
Mr. Honigman?
No.
Mr. Lawrence?
No.
Ms. Novosel?
No.
Mr. Rice?
No.
Mr. Yates?
No.
Ms. Williamson?
No.
Ms. Gustafson?
No.
Madam Chair, the motion fails.
Okay. Whoops, thank you very much. Thanks for your time. Okay, with that, then we'll move on to item 8. And this is a workshop we're going to conduct today on the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Initiative and conceptual proposal on density, height, and coverage for affordable and workforce housing related to chapters 30, 31, 37, 50, 52, and 90. Information on this item can be found on page 67 of our packet. And as a reminder to the public, after the staff presentation and board discussion on this item, you may raise your hand in person or in the Zoom webinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff to share your comments. And while you're getting set up, both Karen and Alyssa, I wanted to make sure all the board members have seen, I believe, we have had written comments from Ms. Balkwell, Ms. Nichols, Ms. Waller, Ms. Black, Mr. Flaherty, and Ms. I don't know how to say her last name, to Singdinus. Did I get it right? Is that close? Okay. So I know I've read all those emails, and I just want to direct board members. We have received quite a few emails in public comment already on this item. I'm sure some of those are in attendance and may speak to us later. So with that, I've spoken long enough that Karen and Alyssa are ready to go.
Good afternoon, members of the board, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for requesting this workshop on housing. We're very excited to present to you today. So coming out of the retreat, we heard an appetite from the board to get more deeply into these planning issues. So what we put together for you today is a workshop. First, we're going to give you some background on the process. Then we're going to get a little more into the details of the current phase of work, and get your input on the current policy proposal that we're working on to encourage affordable and workforce housing. And I just want to emphasize again, we really appreciate your attention to this and your interest in for inviting us to do this workshop, because the shortage of affordable and workforce housing is an increasingly dire crisis. And if, you know, it's been exacerbated by the recent pandemic and other current events, and if we don't take significant action soon, we're going to face a crisis in delivering even the basic mission of the regional plan. We're already seeing, you know, the difficulty in delivering the basic function of our communities. And so those have been very much affected, not to mention individual families and people. So, let's see, I didn't advance the slides. So today we're going to go over the process of the Tahoe Living Working Group and talk about how their work is unfolding. And then we're going to tie that into the housing work that we're going to look at, how housing fits into the regional plan and how it ties into some fundamental concepts of the regional plan. And then we'll look at challenges that we still have today and kind of how well we're doing at addressing some of those fundamental, you know, environmental concepts of the regional plan. Then we'll stop and have questions. I'm going to give the overview, and then we'll turn it over to Alyssa, and she'll get more into the details of the proposal and transition into the interactive part of the workshop. So housing is a very daunting problem to look at, and particularly when you're looking at it through the lens of what your organization alone can do, it can, you know, that can look small. But luckily, TRPA is working as one of many partners that are working on this and have been working for several years on the issue. And in June of 2020, the TRPA Governing Board appointed the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group to look specifically at actions that TRPA could take. And this committee, this working group, is a committee of the Advisory Planning Commission, and it follows all the, you know, same protocols of the Advisory Planning Commission. It's chaired by the chair of the APC. And this strategy of forming working groups either through the APC or through board committees is something that TRPA has found works really well, because we can bring practitioners with expertise in the topic, and also representatives from groups that are affected by the issue together to really advise staff on, you know, what works and what may need to be changed with our policies. So here's a list of stakeholders. We have four representatives from the governing board on the working group, two from the regional plan implementation committee, and two from the local government and housing committee. Thank you. And we know that next month the board is going to be looking at committee assignments. So if you're interested in joining this committee, please let us know. The working group got rolling in August of 2020. And we started by bringing a technical analysis forward to the working group that helped the group prioritize a set of actions based on the amount of impact those actions could have on providing actual numbers of housing units and also reducing the cost of housing. And we showed that from those actions, we can anticipate about a 10 to 12% reduction in costs from TRPA actions. And we're anticipating that, compounded with that work of other partners, that, you know, those actions would build on each other. So the slide is showing a simplified version of the set of actions and the timing that the Tahoe Living Working Group recommended and that the governing board approved in January of 2021. We have shifted a few items around based on timing. For instance, we completed one of the long-term items in the near-term phase. And also the working group has identified that some items need to be dealt with in a different order. So because there have been some minor changes like that, we've included an updated matrix of priority actions in the operations work plan, which is going to you for approval next month. So the first set of actions were the near-term actions. And the main piece of that was the governing board approved allowing accessory dwelling units on all residential parcels on the California side. And that helped local jurisdictions comply with California law. Now we're in the medium-term phase. And this phase is really looking at how can we make it more financially feasible to build multifamily development types that provide smaller units and that more diversity of housing sizes that we want to see for our local workforce. And we anticipate that this phase will take a minimum of 2 years. We're already 1 year in. And I'm going to go into a little more detail on this later in the presentation. And then after that, we'll move into the long-term phase where we want to look at streamlining our permitting and having more consistency between how we permit single-family homes and multifamily homes, because right now multifamily permitting faces more barriers than single-family homes. And we also want to look at our mitigation programs and how they may be affecting the cost of affordable housing. So this slide just emphasizes we are in the medium term phase now. So housing has been built into the regional plan since early on. When you look at the 1987 plan, you can see there's a subchapter devoted to the land use element devoted to housing. In 2012, the governing board approved the sustainable communities strategy as part of the regional plan, and that included a numeric housing goal, and that was tied to state of California requirements for local jurisdictions to show that they can provide a certain amount of affordable housing. And now we have the Tahoe Living Strategic Initiative, which is part of the operations work plan. There's two themes that are kind of emerge from the regional plan that I want to emphasize that really touch on the work that we're, kind of the phase of work that we're in now. So these themes are related to our environmental protection goals. And the first one is concentrating development in appropriate areas. So this is just basically a good planning principle that many regions do. So trying to, do compact development, reduce impacts on water quality, vehicle miles traveled, and get development where you have existing infrastructure. Another theme of our regional plan that's more unique to the Tahoe Basin is our growth management system, where we limit overall development and meter it out over time. So even within this growth management system, from 1987, the regional plan always recognized that there needed to be kind of a set aside to encourage affordable housing and multi-residential development within that growth management system. So from 1987 and continuing on, there's been a set aside of a pool of bonus unit development rights, and it's been dedicated in 1987, it was dedicated to affordable housing and multi-residential development rights, and we've made adjustments to that over time. So in 2012, we had the big regional plan update that really focused on incentivizing development in town centers. So concentrating development in town centers, that's where we saw the height, density, and coverage incentives for development in town centers. And here, this was also based on the outcomes of the TMDL, the total maximum daily load, that showed that the vast majority of sediment loading into the lake was coming from the urban uplands. And the 2012 regional plan also identified that there was still a need to mitigate the impacts of development on workforce housing. So we had that pool of development rights for affordable housing, but there was still a challenge providing housing for people with incomes over affordable, but who still, coucouldn't afford local housing. So that led to the 2018 Development Rights Strategic Initiative. And that initiative was focused on looking at our growth management system and making changes within that system to make it easier to get development rights for redevelopment in town centers and for what we've called the achievable category. So for slightly higher income work income groups. And this amendment also approved the bonus unit boundary, which incentivizes deed restricted housing within the vicinity of town centers and transit. And then in 2021, in July, the governing board approved that first phase of work that came out of the Tahoe Living Working Group. And that again touched on these two themes. But there are still some challenges that are remaining. That, and this is what we kind of want to look at. So the next couple slides look at how are we doing at achieving the compact development goals and how are we doing at providing that affordable housing. And the local governments have identified that we still have a mismatch between available development rights and the needed housing types. So this slide shows the shift of development into centers over the last 10 years. Since the 2012 regional plan amendment. So overall, there's been a shift of slightly under 1% for residential development into town centers, but slightly more for tourist and commercial. This doesn't look like a lot, but of the new development that occurred over the past 10 years, the residential development, nearly half of it went into town centers. That's compared to our existing residential development, only about 4.5% is in town center. So we're definitely seeing that our incentives are having an effect, but there's more that we can do. There's been quite a bit of redevelopment since 2012 also, and a major project that happened right before 2012 was actually the Heavenly Village Center, which brought some of the mixed use and water quality and vehicle miles traveled reductions that we would like to see in our town centers. Since 2012, we have had some redevelopment projects that have taken advantage of town center incentives like the Event Center, Sugar Pine Affordable Housing Project, Tahoe City Lodge. And we've also seen projects deliver hundreds of acres of SEZ restoration and about 600 new units of deed restricted housing or rental apartments. But a lot of the new development that's gone in has not taken advantage of those town center incentives. So we've seen a lot of one-story commercial development, such as the Bijou Whole Foods or the Crossings at the Y. Those have provided some great community revitalization, but they haven't been that mixed use, you know, development with housing that we were anticipating. But what we have been seeing is that single family homes outside of town centers are very able to take full advantage of the development footprint that the development standards allow them. So single family homes are getting bigger and bigger. And it varies a little bit what we see from community to community. So there's definitely a demand for big homes. In Incline Village, for instance, though, we're seeing a demand for condos of all sizes for non-resident, you know, non-local worker uses. And this gets, again, at this issue that the local governments have really been emphasizing in our working group meetings, that it's very easy to get, or relatively easy to get, development rights for this type of housing, large single family, or even deed restricted affordable through achievable. But for smaller non-deed restricted accessory dwelling units or rental apartments, that is the hardest type of development to get development rights for. And then finally, this slide gets at how are we doing at delivering on that affordable housing need that's been identified since 1987 in the regional plan. So regional housing needs assessments that have been conducted by our partner organizations, such as the Tahoe Prosperity Center and the Mountain Housing Council, Washoe County and Placer County have done extensive housing needs research. Those studies have shown that we need an additional 4,500 units of affordable through workforce housing by 2026, in addition to those 600 units that have been built over the last 10 years. And you can see from the graph that over half of our existing housing stock is used for basically second home use types. And then of the other 22,000 units, we've we've been looking at some data that's showing that we think about another 5,000 of those units are vulnerable to eroding into the second home market over, you know, a period of time because they are single family rentals that are most susceptible to being purchased and turned into second homes.
Is it okay to ask a question?
Okay.
Yes. Just that, so that's a snapshot for right now. Do you have any data that shows that change over time, particularly in the last 5 years, what that pie chart looked like?
The change from vacant homes to,
right.
I could provide that for you.
Because it would just be good to see a trajectory over time and maybe with that trajectory over time, sort of showing the points in time where different regulations have come into place too. So we can see the impacts of those if they've been, you know, what you're saying, it would just be nice to see it graphically.
Yeah,
possible. Thanks.
Definitely. So this brings us back to where we are in the action items that the Tahoe Living Working Group has identified. So now we're in this medium-term phase. Today, we're going to be focused on looking at our development standards in town centers and in the vicinity of town centers. And this is that focus on concentrating development in appropriate areas. And then after, at another date, not today, we want to start a discussion with you on building off the work of the Development Rights Strategic Initiative to look at continuing to address the mismatch of available development rights with needed housing types. So we will bring that forward to you as soon as we can. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to the chair and to see if there's any questions on this part of the presentation before we turn to Alyssa's phase two discussion.
Thank you, Karen. Great job. Questions, board members, or comments? Yes, Scott.
How do we keep these new housing developments from converting from affordable or workforce housing into regular housing or vacation housing? Because I think that's something that may have happened over the years. I know that 20 some odd years ago, I'd worked on a project up here at Ski Run Marina area, looking at low-income housing that was there, and that basically was going to be turned into condos, rental condos, and ultimately became a hotel, or ultimately was raised, and a hotel was built on the site. So how do we maintain that if we're going to go forward with affordable and workforce housing, that it may, that we maintain that housing?
One of the tools we have to protect housing is our deed-restricted, affordable, moderate, and achievable homes. So we have a set of incentives. You know, we've provided breaks from our, or, you know, waivers of our mobility mitigation fee and our application fees. There's no cost for development right if you're deed-restricting the unit. So we've really tried to incentivize deed-restricted units, which do tend to, they protect the units over time. And we've also recently increase the kind of compliance language that we have in our code and our deed restrictions for those types of units. So if they're deed restricted, they're pretty well protected to the extent that we can, you know, maintain a robust compliance program. The units that aren't deed restricted, that are market rate, you know, market rate apartments, I think there really is a challenge in trying to keep those from turning into second homes or condos or homes for remote workers, which, you know, is also, you know, helpful for our community in some ways, but it's not always providing support for our local businesses. Cool. There's challenges with that. And local jurisdictions have some tools in their toolbox too.
I was going to say too, when we take out affordable housing with a development, they have to replace it. So I think what we're seeing that we're most worried about is not that, but is the single family that right now is being used by local workforce that's rented to them, converting over to single family that would become a short-term rental or second home or something like that. So same thing Ashley was asking for data about. That's the vulnerable 5,000 that we're looking at. And that's, I would like to tell you, and here's what we're going to do about it, but that's, we don't have that solution yet.
If I may, I know that when we were following up with this project, there were also, you know, homes and condos that were being rented by multiple families you know, and you might have 15 or 20 people living in what would be a two-bedroom apartment or a single-family home because they either work different shifts. But it was quite apparent even back then that there was this very much a shortage of affordable housing up here for the workforce. So just make sure we keep those things in mind. And to follow up again, while I'm thinking about this, are we taking into consideration, you know, qualifications for getting affordable housing, or, you know, versus, you know, somebody coming in and saying, well, I need affordable housing, and basically using it as their residence when they really don't need it? How are we looking at all the different state and county requirements for say affordable housing qualification?
So we do have qualifications built into our code for affordable, moderate, and our achievable category. So the person needs to demonstrate that their income meets those requirements. We're kind of in the midst of doing an update to our achievable deed restriction to make it more focused on having the household work in the basin rather than tied to their income. But our system works is that every year, the people that live in the unit or that own the unit are required to send us a compliance form verifying that they meet the requirements. And then we will periodically do audits to check. That's how our system works currently.
Sorry. And I failed to identify myself, Scott Anderson, for the record. How do you juggle the qualifications that are required or local requirements for, say, Washoe County versus Placer County versus South Lake Tahoe, versus different areas that might have in their own codes requirements, or even state law regarding qualifications for low-income housing and how that, how to keep up with that. So is that part of your audit process?
Do you mean an apartment building or a unit might have a deed restriction from a local government and a deed restriction from us? Or do you just mean statewide requirements that apply to all deed restricted housing or local requirements that are kind of blanket?
I think, Scott, really the question is they're all additive. We don't replace local jurisdiction if they have additional requirements. Generally, it's more the case that there is no local requirement. But if there is additional requirements, then they have to meet, the occupants have to meet all requirements to be entitled to live there if, you know, ours are additive, not replacing.
Thank you.
I'll add to that too. We are working, for example, Placer County came up with a workforce housing requirement or program. And we're trying to align ours so that somebody building affordable housing doesn't have to do five different things in five different places. So we're trying to align them where we can.
And I would just add, as further response on those multifamily and conversion, it is on, isn't it? Yeah. by capping new short-term rental permits and allowing only one per property, we're trying to discourage. We were seeing an abundance of people going out and buying duplexes and triplexes and trying to convert them into vacation home or short-term rentals. And so we've tried to put a stop to that. We lost some in that they were vulnerable and they went before we kept up with the market. Government's a little slower, but I know various jurisdictions are dealing with that in different ways and trying to amend as new ideas come up. We're trying to respond to preserve that workforce housing as much as we can. Shelley had a question.
You know, maybe it's already been answered. Karen, I just need you to clarify something that you said in response to one of the questions. So we have a deed restriction with respect to affordability. And did you indicate that we're also making it mandatory that applicants demonstrate that they are employed in the basin in order to be eligible to occupy these units?
The Tahoe Living Working Group moved forward some code amendments for the achievable category only. So affordable and moderate would stay the same. They still have to meet income requirements. But for units that are deed restricted to the achievable category, the proposal was to replace the income requirement with a workforce requirement, a local work requirement. So they would be required to work. The household that occupies the unit would be required to work, have at least one member working 30 hours, a minimum of 30 hours a week in the basin.
And why was that restricted to achievable? Because it ran afoul of state regulations?
Yes. So potentially, yes. And there was quite a bit of, you know, recognition that there's a lot of people that are on Social Security or, you know, retirees who have lived here for many, many years, and that they're appropriate residents for those units as well.
So, you know, I remember during our review of the Sugar Pine Village project that, you know, I asked a similar question about how we, you know, ensure that the majority of these units are occupied by people who are working in the basin, because that's the whole intent of this exercise, right? And the response was, well, we're reaching out to employers, and I don't know. It would be nice to get kind of a postmortem on some of these projects to determine how many of the residents are actually people working in the basin, because obviously, you know, I understand that we can't do anything that's contrary to state law. Well, theoretically, we can, I suppose. but in the spirit of cooperation, we're not going to do that. But it would be nice to get some data from these completed projects to kind of inventory the people who are staying in those units and how many of them are actually employed in the basin. I've always been fearful of people coming into the basin to occupy these units. What a beautiful place to live, you know, especially if you can get it at a real affordable price. But the other thing I think maybe the local jurisdictions need to consider is developing a reservation list, reaching out to employers, you know, determining how many of those employees are, commuting into the basin from areas outside of the basin, and maybe do a targeted marketing approach for future units, reaching out to those people specifically in order to ensure that a larger ratio of these units is actually being occupied by people working in the basin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Shelley, I like your suggestion to add, I live in the basin, and these are just anecdotal stories, but my daughter goes to daycare whose providers don't live in the basin and actually told us they couldn't keep working at the daycare in Tahoe. It was too expensive to commute back and forth, and they just couldn't find housing. And then my son goes to school in the basin, and there are children that can be considered effectively homeless at his school because they live in motels in the area. So in addition to reaching out to employers, I'm wondering if schools, school-aged children, children who live here and do not have stable housing, are also people that are very high in my priority list. So thank you for that suggestion.
Mm-hmm. And I know from Placer County's standpoint, our Health and Human Services Department is constantly working with those in need to identify those issues. You know, I think all of our counties do that.
Sue. Thank you. Yeah, and I'll just kind of go. My daughter lives near Aspen, and they actually have deed restricted housing for daycare providers, specifically because it is such an issue. Mm-hmm. Certainly something I've talked to Sugar Pine about. They haven't even broken ground yet, so we can't get that information yet from them, but I've been staying on top of where they're going. And, you know, the number one issue we have here in the basin is that the ROI, we're not able to provide the housing because we don't have a developer that can make a profit off of this kind of housing. Until we get there, we figure out a way to either, what we did at Sugar Pine was give them conservancy land to use, which was huge for them, created that ability for them to create all these units. Until we get there, we're not going to get there, because that's why we're getting built bigger homes built, is because the rate of return to those investors is so great, and it's not for these smaller projects. So this is where I think this medium term will be talking about increasing some of this ability for us to make it more attractive for them to build these units we need. But until we get there, we can put all these deed restricted and, you know, in development projects and, you know, and say we do have a pool already of these kind of units, and we can't get developers to buy into it because it's not feasible for them.
That's a great segue to the second part.
I was going to share, John as well, that even just outside the basin in Meadowview Place over in near Schaefer's Mill and Martyrs Camp, we worked with a developer over there, 56 units, and they're not full because not enough people qualify, because most of our employees up here are making too much money to qualify for the tax credit restrictions on income. So it's really a shame to see those sitting somewhat empty right now because we have such dire circumstances with our workforce. But you saw the maid advertised at whatever on your slide for 17 an hour, McDonald's and trucking 19 an hour per salary.
If I might.
Yes.
Madam Chair. Well, and that's why I think, Sue, integrating achievable into medium and low income would certainly help them achieve the rate of return they're looking for, I would think, because if you have variable rates of rent, you know, maybe it'll make it more financially feasible for a developer.
And just to back up on that, Sugar Pine, just over 50% is low and moderate, and then the rest can be market.
It's market. Okay.
Yeah. Under 50%.
So and there's right. a reason why haven't they broken ground, just because of the pandemic?
All the stipulations, all the issues. Yeah. They're just not quite there yet. Next year.
John?
Oh, there. It's the other one. Whatever that light was. Some light's on, not the right one. Okay, now that I'm all lit up. Thanks, Karen. And maybe Alyssa will talk about this, but I just want to love to hear more about picking up on what Sue said and what others have said, and Cindy, about the caps on vacation rental disincentives for the non-public serving developments. And I know many of the public comments are about, gee, we're just getting more and more and more. And if the market is delivering monster homes and vacation rentals, and we only have so much coverage to go around, and we're concerned about adding some marginal coverage for incentive, where are the trade-offs? So I'd be interested in hearing about discussions. And I was part of those in the Living Working Group, but just sharing those with us about progressive fee structures or the TAU for vacation rental issue or affordable by design or ways to incentive to have the market deliver the kind of housing we want through measures that disincentivize where the market's going now, so that we're not just looking at the end of the day of the market is delivering lots of huge footprints, and now we have to come up with lots of incentives to do more dense coverage. And at the end of the day, the trade-off is excess coverage on the lake. Excess mitigation coverage fees is another one. Is that something we could look at and not allow to overbuild non-public serving units? So it's kind of like public transportation versus driving. Most people drive because you can drive fast and park for free. Most developers are building big because that's where, like Sue said, you make the return on investment. But what are our tools to disincentivize that, balance the field? So there's a place to make trade-offs as we're allowing more in the public serving housing types.
Thank you, John.
We're glad you asked.
It sounds like we're at a segue.
That's exactly what Alyssa's going to talk about, is we have people look at that.
There we go.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Governing Board. For the record, Alyssa Bettinger with TRPA. And this part of the presentation, again, will focus on development standards. When we talk about development standards, we're really talking about TRPA development standards, which are density, height, and coverage. But also the local jurisdiction standards that they implement also play into this as well, which are primarily parking and setback requirements. And today we are bringing forward a proposal to this board that came from staff, the Tahoe Living Working Group, and the Local Government and Housing Committee. We're asking for guidance and direction before we move forward into the environmental analysis. And the reason that we're talking about development standards is because they dictate the overall building envelope. They control how big of a structure you can have on your property. They control how many units can fit within that structure. And they generally control kind of the look and feel of what our buildings end up being. And while these standards do serve a variety of planning purposes, they often inadvertently disincentivize the type of housing that would typically house our workforce. You can see in the example on the slide here, there is, because of our roof pitch requirements combined with our height, there ends up being a lot of unlivable space on the top floor. And similarly, on the bottom floor, you can see that the red area, that is all devoted to parking. And so when you're building a single family home with this footprint, it actually works. But when you try to fit two units into this, it gets really small to the point where the return on investment for the developer is just not there. And in the last couple of years, we've been working with a few consultants to do some analysis and provide some recommendations to us on how to sort of move forward with incentivizing workforce housing through our development standards. The first presentation that you may have watched prior to this meeting was from OptiCoast Design, where they were talking about the importance of missing middle or middle housing. Which is the type of housing that's kind of smaller scale, duplex, triplex, and fourplex development. And it, you know, seamlessly blends into a lot of lower density neighborhoods. So it's particularly useful in our areas outside of town centers. And then the next analysis that we had done was by Cascadia Partners. And they looked at the financial feasibility of building multifamily housing, both in town centers and outside of town centers. And so I do want to reiterate, Karen talked about this a little bit, but why are we so focused on multifamily housing? And the reason is that multifamily is very effective in that it can be built at a lower cost per unit. So it ends up being more affordable to the person who ends up living in that unit. Multifamily development, that said, needs a different set of development standards in order to be feasible, like you saw on that last slide. And oftentimes, developers who are building multifamily run up against these development standards much quicker than someone who's building a single family home. And in the past, we have recognized that different uses need different development standards to pencil out. And so to encourage more concentrated growth, in the past, we have increased our development standard allowances in town centers. So right now we allow up to 70% coverage. We allow density up to 25 units per acre. We allow height up to 4 stories. And really the limitation in our town centers right now is just the amount of land that's available. There's not a lot of parcels that are suitable for multifamily development because these areas are relatively small. And despite those development or those higher development incentives, we're still not getting the housing that we want to see in our town centers. And part of the analysis that Cascadia completed for us identified why. And they found that because we allow higher coverage, height, and density, there are incentives, but the incentives aren't aligned. And so you can see on this slide here, and in their example that they provided in the analysis was that on a 12,000 square foot lot at 25 units per acre, that limits the development to no more than 6 units. And if you were to increase density or factor out density and just rely on other standards like our coverage and height and parking requirements, you could get to 11 units. And furthermore, when you're developing only 6 units in a town center, The analysis showed that you really only need 34% coverage and only 3.5 stories. And so by limiting the density to 25 units per acre, you're sort of constraining the development incentives that other that coverage and height are offering. In the vicinity of town centers, we are also focused on housing. These areas are really important for providing the density and support needed to have high frequency transit in our centers, have thriving restaurants and shops and businesses. And so we, as part of this, the recommendation, we have recommendations for both in town centers and in the vicinity of town centers. And outside of our town centers, we allow coverage up to 30%. We allow density up to 15 units per acre, depending on where you are in the basin. And we allow height up to 36 feet on a flat lot. Yeah.
How do you define in the vicinity of? Is there a mileage, like some distance from the town center?
So in this, we have been focused on all the areas that are already zoned for multifamily. Those are typically pretty close to our town centers. So those are kind of the two different areas, town centers and then in areas that are already zoned for multifamily.
Okay.
And in these areas, outside of our town centers, we're again seeing that our density allowances are generally too low to encourage housing types like duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. Oftentimes, this is because these parcels in these areas are very small. You can see in this example that on a 6,000 square foot lot at 8 units per acre, you can't actually get to a multifamily development. You can only have one unit. And 6,000 square foot lot is actually a really common parcel size in these areas. So this is a very common example that even though we allow multifamily in these areas, and for reference in the map here, it's all of the areas that are shown in various shades of red allow for multifamily. But again, in a lot of these areas, we allow it, but you can't actually get there because of our density standards. And all of this goes to show that our densities are too low to support transit and support our services. And we did a quick analysis of gross density. So allowable density and gross density are a little bit different. Gross density is looking at the sum of all densities spread out over all of the parcels. And so this table is showing the gross density of town centers and within a quarter mile of town centers. And you can see that even though we allow up to 25 units per acre density in our town centers, the gross density is actually much lower. So in the state line area, in the South Shore, which is our most dense area, it's less than 10 units per acre. And typically, you want to see between 15 and 20 units per acre gross density to support high frequency transit. And so we're really seeing that we need to focus on higher density in these specific areas. And then just again, one of the reasons why we are focusing on both town centers and outside of town centers is that the amount or the number of available parcels that would be suitable for multifamily. So looking at land capability, whether they are privately owned, there is a very limited amount of parcels that are available for that inside of town centers. But when we expand it to even a quarter mile outside of town centers, that number increases pretty significantly. So all of this background leads us to the work that we are doing around shaping TRPA's development standards to incentivize that type of workforce housing development and implement other regional plan goals. And as we move into the environmental analysis in the next phase, We would like to consider options for density that support transit services and really do encourage walkable communities. So the first three density proposal options for town centers, first option would be to allow increased density up to 40 units per acre in town centers. We would like to look at 40 units per acre as sort of a starting point for our densities in these areas. And the reason that we're looking at 40 units per acre is because our tourist densities currently in town centers, that is the allowable density. So that's a good kind of starting point to help incentivize housing over tourist units in these areas. The second option would look at moving towards allowing or enabling local jurisdictions in California to implement the California Density Bonus Law that was passed in 2021. And essentially this law allows developers who are building multifamily developments with a portion of deed restricted units to increase their density on top of what is already allowed. So for example, if a developer is building a multifamily development that has 25 units that are set aside for deed restricted affordable housing, they could go up an additional 20% density on top of what is allowed. This has been requested from local government staff members and has come out of the Tahoe Living Working Group. And then last, we would like to look at a no density option through a pilot program partnering with the local jurisdictions. And I'll talk about this a little bit in a little bit more in the next few slides, but we would like to explore kind of whether we can rely on other development standards to dictate kind of what the overall look and feel of the development is. And then the developer can decide how many units can fit inside that and how many units are feasible. And then outside of our town centers in the vicinity, we would like to look at a few options that would encourage that middle housing type and really that affordable by design housing type. The first option would allow up to 3 units on all lots that are already zoned multifamily. So this would be regardless of parcel size. The second option would be to increase densities outside of our town centers, but in areas that are already zoned for multifamily, up to 25 units per acre. And again, that would just allow that example that you saw on the previous slide at 6,000 square feet that you couldn't actually get to multifamily. That would provide opportunities for those parcels to go a little bit larger. And then similarly with coverage, we're exploring options for coverage that would support water quality in soils, but would also provide the flexibility that's needed to build compact development that's close to our centers. The first coverage option in town centers would utilize stormwater infrastructure to provide water quality and soil protection. This option would allow TRPA to partner with local jurisdictions and developers who are interested in building 100% deed restricted housing developments. And as part of that, they would install stormwater infrastructure that would capture and treat the stormwater runoff before it reaches the lake. And there is, there are some good examples of this already happening in the basin. One area are the stormwater basins that were installed to treat the runoff from the Heavenly Village. And as part of that, they were built to accommodate up to 95% coverage. And we've actually seen a reduction in pollutant loading in those areas. So there are some good models that we can look to for this. Again, this would be in targeted areas in town centers and would require a partnership with local jurisdictions and developers who are interested. But we do think that there are options out there kind of outside of our traditional coverage system that would provide flexibility to developers with the amount of pervious surface or impervious surface that they're adding and would provide water quality benefits.
Is that a natural bioswale or is it an engineered water filtration?
It's an engineered.
Okay, thanks.
And then outside of tone centers, we would like to look at an option that would expand some of our tone center coverage incentives to deed restricted multifamily or ADUs. Again, in tone centers, we allow up to 70% coverage. So we would like to look at whether we could expand that 70% allowance to deed restricted housing outside of tone centers. The additional coverage would be available for only the deed restricted unit. And so if someone was putting, say, an ADU in their backyard and they were already at their 30% allowable coverage, we would like to look at whether we could allow them to have an additional 5 or 10% coverage for that deed restricted ADU. We did, in the analysis done by Cascadia, see that only about 34% coverage would be needed for a duplex, and only about 42% coverage would be needed for a triplex. And so that 70% might be more on the high side, but for the purposes of the environmental analysis, we would like to sort of analyze the full envelope and then narrow it down if we need to. And anytime we do allow additional coverage, it needs to be mitigated right now. And so that happens currently through excess coverage mitigation fees and through transferring in coverage. So through this environmental analysis, we'd like to look at alternative mitigation strategies that would kind of go a step further in incentivizing deed-restricted housing, sort of what John was alluding to earlier, of how can we kind of shape our mitigation fees and requirements to incentivize the type of development that we want to see. And then the last development standard that we'll touch on is height. The objective with height is to maintain our scenic thresholds and maintain the community of the character of our communities. We're really not intending to allow a lot of extra height that is not in line with either our scenic regulations or community character. So because of this, the height proposals are not significant, but we do feel like they might provide, or they would provide a little bit more flexibility to developers just needing that extra 1 or 2 feet in order to make their development pencil. So the height proposal in town centers, one would be to enable California jurisdictions to take advantage of the height flexibility that's included in the California density bonus law. This law is not just focused on density. It also includes some other incentives for height and parking as well. And so we've received some requests from local jurisdiction staff that we look at whether we could allow local jurisdictions in California to take advantage of this. The second option that we are planning to look at in the environmental analysis would look at kind of clarifying TRPA code and regional plan language. So right now in the height chapter of our code, it requires, we list number of stories and number of feet. And so developers have to abide by the number of stories. So for example, in town centers, we allow 4 stories and 56 feet. We've received some feedback that they would rather see the number of feet stay the same, but take away the number of stories because they might be able to fit additional stories in that total height. And so we would like to bring back some code that helps to clarify that language. And then in the vicinity of town centers, we would like to reduce or remove roof pitch allowances for deed restricted housing. Again, you saw in that first slide that our roof pitch requirements for the top floor, they can be very steep, which creates sort of an unlivable top floor. It also requires households to heat the top floor when, you know, it might not even be a livable space. And we're also hearing that our roof pitch requirements are not necessarily in line with the more modern architectural styles that a lot of people want to use today. So as part of this, we would like to, again, look at whether we can reduce or remove these roof pitch allowances for deed-restricted housing. And then to sort of tie all of these together, and I know that we have pointed out some of the options that would be more appropriate for in pilot programs, and we did so in the staff report as well. But there is some interest from the local jurisdiction staff in pairing some of these incentives with incentives from their end. So if we, you know, allow higher density, that could be appropriate to pair with reduced parking requirements or potentially no parking requirements if it's in a very specific location that's served by transit and close to services. And so as part of this phase, we will be working or we'll continue to work with local jurisdiction staff to see if there are opportunities where we can build in these pilot programs, even to sort of test the impacts and the results of some of the options that we're bringing forward today. So before we get into the interactive component of this housing workshop, I do want to quickly note that, again, this is the proposal that came out of our work with the Tahoe Living Working Group. We will be moving into the environmental analysis after this, and we would like to sort of analyze the full picture of everything. So, you know, we would like to move into looking at kind of the highest density, and even if we're looking at it, doesn't mean that that will be in the final proposal. And then just one other quick note is that a lot of these options would be implemented through amending our regional plan and code, but it would also need to be amended through the local jurisdiction's area plans. So they would have the option to sort of take advantage of these options if they feel like they are in line with what their community needs. So I just want to make certain that everyone is clear on, you know, these would not take immediate effect in all of the local jurisdictions. It would be sort of on a case-by-case basis. So with that, we, in the essence of it being a housing workshop, we wanted to make this a little bit interactive. And because we don't have too many members of the public, we were going to break out into three groups. And I think maybe we will just count off governing board members one, two, and three. And then Belinda and I think Alexis maybe she's still on.
I'm still Belinda, on.
Okay, perfect. They will stay in this room. So you guys don't need to count off.
Okay. So you'd like us to start off. Wes, you're number one. Yes, you are.
Two.
Three. One.
Two.
I'm staying. I have to go.
Oh.
One.
Three. Perfect. Okay, so the ones are going to stay in this room. The twos are going to go into the Washoe Fremont room in the back. And then the threes are going to go to the front room just across the hall, and all these rooms are labeled. But before you go, we're going to spend 15 minutes in each room. John, Karen, and I are going to rotate. So we're going to talk, one of us is going to be on density, one of us is going to be on coverage, one of us is going to be on height. So you'll have an opportunity to ask questions and kind of talk about the proposal for each of these. And we will do a report out at the end. We'll come back together. And let's
see. We will be recording in each room.
We will be recording in each room. And these are the questions that we would like your input on. So number one, what part of the proposals do you want us to continue to develop? Number two, what additional options or ideas do you have that you want us to consider? And number three, are there any specific concerns or questions that you have that you want us to address in this next phase going through the environmental analysis? And these questions will be in all of the breakout stations, so you don't need to remember these. For virtual members of the public that are online, we do have an option for you to participate as well. It's on the top of the screen. If you go to www.menti.com and enter this code, Catherine will also put it in the chat. You can answer all of these questions as well. So we'd love to hear from you if you are interested.
Can I just add one thing? And that for members of the public here, all of these rooms are open to the public. So you can go in any room you want. If you want to participate and give your thoughts, then you need to go to the front room.
Yes.
The front room over here.
And it's optional if you would like to participate.
Of course, there's always going to be a public comment period at the end of this workshop that you'd be able to provide your comments specifically if you want to.
Alyssa, in each one of the breakout rooms, is there a copy of your presentation? So we know specifically what the options are.
There are, yeah. We have boards that highlight the different options.
And just to be clear, we facilitators will be taking the topics to different rooms instead of you all having to move because of the virtual hybrid. So we don't have to move around. Yeah.
Group one is here, group two is in the Washoe Fremont room, and group three is in the front room.
I am, and I'm setting my iPhone clock for 15 minutes. Here we go. So,
Okay. Sorry, Catherine. Thank you.
Okay. So,
and Belinda and Alexis, make sure you chime in if you have questions.
Okay. So, the first question for you all is, what part of the proposals do you want us to continue to develop? And I will flip chart. If you say everything, I'll put that up there and we can move to the next one if you want to add some other things. Whatever, let us know.
All right, I'll get the party started.
Okay.
Or did you have yours on? Sunday?
No, I had it on just to
have it on. All right. Okay, in general, I support all the recommendations. I do have a couple coverage additions. One is a question about the differentiating between, in allowing extra coverage for an ADU, 5% additional coverage. Could you not just expand the total footprint, say, to 35%, whether or not it's an ADU or the main house? If, for example, you're adding a junior ADU or putting an ADU above a garage, does it matter necessarily how that's configured if at the end of the day you're adding another housing unit?
So you want the percentage coverage to go up if you add units?
Well, in this proposal, it would allow 5% coverage to be added for an ADU. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, could you perhaps also allow 5% coverage to the single family home if it includes an addition of an ADU, like an ADU? So you're not, in a sense, splitting hairs between how that 35% happened as long as you're getting an ADU. Again, it could be above a garage or, you know, another subdivision of that main house that increases coverage. So long as you get additional living space in the form of an ADU. So that's one idea. I just want to flag that in the pilot program discussion, the 100% affordable housing project did not include Tahoe Valley Town Center, removing density requirements for 100% affordable housing projects, did not include the Tahoe Valley Town Center. It may have been an omission, but just wanted to note that for the record.
Thanks, John.
And Madam Chair, if I seem ignorant at times, I am, because I am fairly new to this. And so some of the terms, the coverage, the density, all this is fairly new to me. I'm generally aware of it because of the restrictions in the basin in the past. But I guess one of my concerns would be is you're looking at coverage, and so you have a lot in you're covering a good portion of that lot now because you have this these lessened restrictions because of what type of building you're. Is that going to cause not only the density there, the coverage, but the density in that area to be significantly increased? Because I know that there's a lot of concern about there being too much density within the basin. So, how's it? And again, yeah.
Good so question.
Should that be
a concern? Yeah. Both Alexis and Belinda have their hands up, so I'll get you in here in just a minute. John is writing slowly, so I need to give him time to capture the thoughts neatly. And he's writing very neatly, too. Okay, Belinda, you can go. He's listening.
Sure. So my input is reflects, I think, what's already been said by John and others, that, you know, all of these ideas, I think, should be explored. One of the priorities, though, I'd like to make sure that we instill in this process is to look at where our major public transit corridors are and really emphasize trying to facilitate development ideas for those particular corridors as a priority. I think if we're going to get our public transportation system to work effectively, people need to live within walking distance of those transportation corridors. So that would be, I think, a real high priority that we should look at. And I totally agree with John's comments about looking at density issues outside of the town centers, in particular when it comes to single family residents and being able to add ADUs and also, making sure that we look at where some of the transportation corridors are adjacent to those facilities. And, integrated planning is something that I think about a lot in terms of ensuring that, we're considering, where are we having development that's close to places where people need to recreate, which obviously is a big opportunity in Tahoe, but also where they need to go to the market, how do they get to the laundromat, all of those day-to-day necessities that I think we need to think about, in particular with dense housing that might not have some of the amenities within their unit. So that would be my input in thinking that we really have to make sure that we're maximizing the opportunity for leveraging public transit.
Thanks, Belinda. Great comment.
If I put mixed use down for your latter part, is that what you're talking about? I know I got.
Yeah, mixed use, which is direct. Yeah, which is directed towards residential services. I mean, a lot of times, frankly, mixed use ends up being things that service tourist industry more than it does local residents. So. I know that there's pros and cons about, the local market at the corner, and, we don't want 7-Elevens on every other block, but, people do need to be able to have walkable distances to be able to get, a quart of milk or, whatever it is that they need for their daily lives. So how do we, factor that into to this planning so that people don't have to jump in their car to get to the Safeway or, whatever, the Raley's, whatever it may be. Okay.
Great, Belinda. Alexis, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really love what Belinda brought up. I was writing down a similar note on this idea of town centers and what we're doing through Placer County and the Visitors Bureau up in Incline Village, and then also what's happening on the South Shore for microtransit and how there's some things we can look into about that first and last mile. And I think that it's very smart to look at expanding the density outside of the town centers, you know, with those things in our mind and considered. And Belinda also brought up zoning, and I think that's something that we need to look at for our particular area plan and incline. I'm finding that allowing for more mixed use zoning in some areas of our community would be helpful to get more residential. So I think that's something that we need to consider, and perhaps it's a Washoe County issue, or maybe TRPA can assist with that. And I'm very excited about that we're looking at coverage so aggressively. I've spoken to many developers who have complained about the coverage issues and developing some sort of housing, more dense housing product, workforce housing product in Klein Village. So I think looking at the science of you know, the BMPs and how we can utilize stormwater infrastructure. And I think that that's really exciting and seeing, you know, every lot is going to be a little bit different. The other thought I had, and I don't know if it's appropriate for this part of the workshop or if it can be discussed later, a lot of public commenters from my district had concerns that these issues were not being looked at under the lens of Nevada state law. And I just wanted to maybe get that in a parking lot so we can make sure we bring that up maybe when we come together as the board again, and that we have looked at those issues or what those issues are. So we can make sure that we address those concerns by the public. And let's see, I'm very excited about the deed restricted coverage change that's going to be looked at as well. So overall, very supportive of what we have before us. Thank you.
John, I had Wes, did you have anything? I was going to jump in, but I have something to suggest. Can you?
South Lake Tahoe has an advantage over Douglas County, as in Douglas County is not flat. And most everything that we have is built on the side of a hill. And to try to put EDUs or town centers on the Nevada side, number one, there's no dirt that you can build on. I know in the area that I live in, I believe there are three lots that are buildable that are not built on yet. And none of them would support anything larger than a single family dwelling. Or it would have to be a very small duplex. But I don't think the neighborhood would allow that, if you know what I mean. We have a very small area of affordable housing in Round Hill.
Yeah.
We have Gold Hill, and then we have a few apartments and I guess fourplexes that are down off of it's the name of the street, especially when I lived there. Anyway, not on it, but close to it. But so we're at a disadvantage trying to accomplish anything like this on our side.
Right. And I would share that same concern on North Shore. So many of the maps today focused on South Shore and huge town centers, where North Shore town centers, especially Tahoe City, are extremely narrow and only include the commercial corridor and very little residential area to even consider. So I like the idea of outside of town centers or nearby town centers, because some of those areas, had we been trying to deal with housing when the area plans went through, we probably would have fought harder to have larger areas for our town centers, but not for commercial development, but for supportive housing. I had a question on the in-town centers. You want to limit the coverage to 100% deed-restricted developments. And similar to what Sue Novosel said, Supervisor Novosel said, we find that there's very few developers who can make a project pencil unless they have some market rate or some economic incentives. So do we have to be at 100% deed restricted, or could it be 75% and or 85%? I mean, is there some number of market rate units that help pencil the project and we still get much more deed restricted housing? Does it?
Yeah, let me see if I, because I've been thinking about this since it came out of the working group, is if you're going to put a stormwater system in, you don't want to put it in and it covers an area that has market and deed restricted. You want to say, sorry, you're in market rate, you can't be in the stormwater system. So I think what we really need to look at is that stormwater system includes market rate units, mm-hmm. I think is what you're saying, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, and that's good planning, right?
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
and scale and having yeah. operational support for it. I'm just trying to make sure that even a new development could take advantage of this system with less than 100% deed restricted. But I understand the concern. We don't want to open that up to just developers. So what is the percentage of non-deed restricted units that would make a project pencil so we get the housing built? Because we've been talking about this for 6 years on North Shore. We still don't have very many units built.
Well, and, you know, frankly, we got stormwater systems put in that work better than BMPs.
Oh, absolutely. And they're maintained publicly, and they're absolutely, because the BMPs get filled up and nobody comes back around. But stormwater systems.
Even if we got very little affordable housing, it's still an environmental benefit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, John.
Okay. One is I just want to, for the record, at least for the California side, align everything, density, height, and other allowances of the California density bonus law. Maybe that's part of it, but just to underscore that is a good idea. The next part might be contradictory or at odds in a way. I mean, at one level, I would just say whatever we can do to permit, I mean, to streamline the analysis phase, the environmental analysis for the basin. To help streamline the local area plan process, some of which will need to be amended to incorporate these changes. I'm thinking of the Tahoe Valley Plan or the TCAP that we talked about earlier today or other plans. We're doing it now, the city, once a year in the fall. So, gosh, you know, the faster this can go, the better to deal with the crisis. I would just say, like, every possible effort would be good to know what is the proposed timeline and are there ways to make that faster. On the other hand, you know, like we're just following up on what Scott said and what I alluded to earlier, what I would like to see to address the concerns about greater impacts, whether it's from additional coverage or density, which might mean like traffic, right, or other impacts to the basin, that the environmental analysis ought to look at compensatory reductions elsewhere, aka what are their disincentives to reduce excess coverage. Do we eliminate excess coverage mitigation fees for non-public serving benefits? Do we add TAU requirements to vacation rentals? Do we do much different fee structure that really makes it difficult to build a monster home so that the additional impacts analyzed under these incentives are offset somewhere? In it, you know, beyond mitigation measures, which sometimes work and sometimes we don't know if they work. But if you had, you know, for every bit of new coverage here, you're reducing it somewhere else in areas that aren't serving a local housing need. That seems to me would be fair game for the analysis. And I said that's a bit of a contradiction because I'd like to see it go fast. But on the other hand, you can anticipate objections from the public for the same reason Scott said. What are the trade-offs?
Scott Anderson, because you have the argument that, you know, we don't want this in our neighborhood. I mean, we don't because we've built our houses in these areas that are now all of a sudden we drive through and we have highly dense areas of development that they didn't want. And they've been talking about not having any more development in the, you know, for years. I've lived in Carson City for 50 years, and one of the things that they were always talking about is we got to quit building in the basin and we don't want anymore. Now we're talking about okay, we've been building in the basin, now we're going to build more in the basin. And so you're going to, there's just going to be that, that line of thought or that argument against doing something like this, because there is going to be potentially a load of development in the basin.
Madam yeah. Chair, it's been a pleasure. It's my 15 minutes with you all is up.
And Belinda just let me know she needs to be done here by 4. So I'm sorry, Belinda, we're going so long, but it's been a been a long day. So we're waiting for our next facilitator. Okay.
Shall we get started with the?
Yes, and just a reminder, we have both Belinda and Alexis online, so I'll look for their hands too.
Great. And so you guys need to remain seated. Is that what we decided, so that you can use your mics?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So does anyone want me to explain the height proposals again, or does anybody have any questions about the height proposal before we start? I'm happy to summarize it quickly if that would be helpful. Nope.
I don't need it.
Okay. All right. So let's look at the first question. What part of the height proposal do you want us to continue to develop? Last time, people just sort of threw out all their ideas related to height, so I think that works pretty well. So what about the proposal, you know, did you like, do you want us to keep? What else do you want to see in the proposal? And it would be great if we could talk about both the town centers and outside of town centers.
Karen, I liked both. I support both and being as flexible. I would actually even go further, you know, in circumstances that justify it. And I know of a parcel right in Tahoe City that backs up to a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impacting anybody's scenic if you went, you know, if it's screened from the lake,
mm-hmm.
it's certainly screened. It's not blocking any views. And is that somewhere where you could actually go another story or two mm-hmm. beyond? Because I know the cost of elevators.
Yeah.
It doesn't vary much going one more story, and yet you get that many more units for housing. So.
Yeah. So are you saying in certain areas, look at maybe one or two stories above what we allow now in town centers, if the site kind of allows for it? Or
we're so different in various areas of the lake, and it really, we should be looking at what's the goal of the scenic.
Yeah.
Is both views from the lake and blocking others' views. And if it does neither, mm-hmm. can you actually even go higher?
Okay, so look more at the goals.
I know that's hard to,
like, look at the goals of the scenic threshold rather than necessary.
Heights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's all right. Hey, I was a cop for 57 years. I don't mind police. It just doesn't seem that some of the rules that we have had here and have had for years just don't seem to make sense. Because the areas are so diverse that there are some areas where you could have 80% coverage and it wouldn't make a hell of a heck of a lot of difference for the lake clarity. And you have areas like in Round Hill where the stormwater runoff is so well managed that the TM is irrelevant because nothing escapes from Round Hill into the lake. Nothing reaches the lake from Round Hill. And yet we require all of our residents to have BMPs, and which is overkill. But I think that's some areas that can be looked at, and it might help bring down.
Here, we can make a note here.
To add that and height, and you're agreeing with height as well, should be indeed based on the circumstances. Of
indeed. My
the
goal, house.
The limitations are based on scenic.
My house sits on a hill, and behind me is Forest Service land, and I don't see anything getting built in there in my lifetime. So what difference does it make if my house is two stories or five stories?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not blocking anybody's view.
Well, it depends on where they're seeing it from. So you have to look at both is why we've developed scenic. Is that correct, John Marshall? It's both the scenic from people driving by as well as blocking views.
A little bit of a nuance there. It's blocking views plus neighborhood characteristics, plus design standards, plus views from the lake, plus views from publicly identified or identified public viewing areas. So
if you could meet certain criteria, another story might not even be, if you could meet all those criteria, whereas I can see in some areas where you can't, having that limit is really positive. But the particular parcel I'm looking at is one we've been talking about for housing right next to our town center, and it's back from the lake and it's not visible. So
adding, you know, let's be blunt, adding height as opposed to the two things that are we're talking about here, which are more of utilizing height more efficiently. That adding height is
a big issue.
Is a bigger issue than these two items.
What the proposal has?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say that in our other group, we had similar input that there needed to be more flexibility on height. They didn't support kind of what the proposal was.
They wanted to go further.
Yeah. They didn't think that changing roof pitch or just making not much change in town centers was enough.
Not that they didn't support those things, but
they thought it wasn't enough. Yeah, they wanted to go further. Yeah.
So they wanted additional height. And what that does is it brings us closer to treetop. And when you start looking at from development from different vantage points, particularly like you're on public roads looking over South Shore or other areas, you start seeing buildings when they're up above.
Absolutely.
And so that's we just need to be careful and go in eyes open that might require substantially more environmental analysis and mitigation and potentially be inconsistent with scenic thresholds than utilizing the space under tree canopy.
So if my point absolutely was if you could meet those, all of that, could you go taller? And those are the issues that you'd have to look at particular sites. Right now, it's an absolute no. If a project proponent could come in or a jurisdiction could come in and say, in this situation, we can meet all those at this particular parcel, is it, can it be flexible?
So what I'm hearing, if I'm hearing this correctly, John, you're saying if someone is proposing quite a bit more height so that it would go over tree canopy, that would be a really significant environmental analysis. But if they're proposing height that doesn't exceed tree canopy, that might be possible or?
Particularly on a case, I think we're talking about two different things. One is kind of a broad standard. And the second one is there may be instances on a case by case basis that you could go higher because of the circumstances of the lot.
Okay. So,
I think what I would it sounds
it
like
it has to be very carefully applied. I understand that.
No, the input is maybe look at additional height, see where you might be able to squeeze something out that won't have these impacts of getting above tree canopy, but also look at a case by case scenario where there could be circumstances of an individual lot that could facilitate additional height and not, because of next to a cliff or something, it's or an outcrop or something that it doesn't pose the same scenic concerns.
Okay. What are your thoughts on height, or should we check with Belinda and Alexis to see if they have?
Belinda, your hand is up.
Yes. And a very interesting conversation. I really think that there are some specific concerns that we would have to have regarding you know, view shed and impacts, environmental impacts to tree, not only tree canopy, but tree root systems and the, just the whole forest system in terms of how it gets impacted by the lack of light and impacts that it might have to hydrology and all of those things. So I totally agree, however, that these are the kinds of things that need to be looked at to mm-hmm. not forestall any opportunities, because there could be that a few perfect situations out there that would exceed the number of feet or number of stories that might work perfectly well. But that's why, you know, the environmental analysis is so critically important. And I agree that looking at other opportunities outside of town centers beyond just roof pitch in order mm-hmm. to be able to maximize the opportunities for multifamily housing is critically important. I think at this stage of the game, there is such a tremendous need. You know, we don't want to limit ourselves in any way in terms of looking at, you know, what's possible.
So am I hearing you say that even outside of town centers, you would want us to go beyond just getting rid of roof pitches and potentially allow more height than we currently allow? For multifamily,
yes, and also, you know, the community character issue. I'm saying within the scope of what we want to achieve, which is to be compatible with those neighborhood characteristics and site conditions and community needs. I mean, you know, you can't look at it just as an isolated issue, but it really is something that we should explore more broadly. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I have very good faith in the process that this is a recommendation that's coming from TRPA that has to be vetted by the jurisdictions that administer these things. That this is just one step in the process. I want to be really clear about that. And I think that it's going to be really, really important to, which I believe TRPA does. We do very well in terms of, you know, staff communicating with the local community, with the stakeholders, not only the, you know, local jurisdictions, but, you know, everyone involved in this. This is going to be a pretty heavy lift, I'm sure.
Thanks, Belinda. Alexis?
I'm finding myself agreeing with the team again. So I would like the options on the screen explored, but also see if there's flexibility if, you know, you meet all these criteria or if it has to go for the board approval, you know, some special noticing, all of those kind of things. I think we should be looking at to see what we can do to support developers on getting an ROI and on these developments. And if that includes height increases within reasonable standards, we should be looking at that.
Okay. John had a comment.
Yeah, just adding my support to the proposals of flexibility within the proposed height in terms of the number of stories and the, you know, not requiring the current roof pitch. And also looking at opportunities for variances on total height in a way that doesn't slow down the streamlined environmental analysis. So maybe that's on a separate track or something. Mm-hmm. If there's a package of things that we say, okay, we can move these quickly through the environmental analysis stage towards adoption and incorporation in the city and county plan updates, then I wouldn't want to have increased height slow that down. If, you know, per Don's comment, if that's a whole nother kettle of fish. But I think it makes sense to really look at it on some track to say, okay, what are the height trade-offs between height and coverage, or, you mm-hmm. know, height and lack of people driving off the hill and having to drive every day, or mm-hmm. homeless encampments. There's lots of trade-offs, right, in terms of impacts and scenic issues of all kinds. So one could imagine this is a lesser problem than those caused by not having affordable housing projects that pencil out.
Mm-hmm.
And if height makes those happen, then we should seriously look at, you know, all kinds of height variances. But so long as this whole package isn't slowed down by that one issue.
Right. So short-term. Good point.
Yeah, that's interesting. That sounds like something that should be considered in the environmental analysis, some of the trade-offs that you get with more height. It might be worth it to get more height if you're, you know,
yeah, but I was just saying too, but if that element of the environmental analysis ends up being very cumbersome mm-hmm. and gets into all kinds of other issues that then makes the process 6 months or 12 months longer than I would say put it on a separate track.
Okay. Scott?
Real quick. As far as the roof pitch is concerned, will there be guidance in regards to, say, design or safety issues, you know, snow load, things of that sort, just because you don't want a bunch of boxes sitting out there, you know, three-story boxes with flat roofs or pitches that aren't going to properly deal with the snow loads and things mm-hmm. like that. And also just the aesthetics of the area, you know, just making sure that there still is, you know, the design fits within the basin.
Yeah, let's write that also design concerns with, I mean, you sort of already got it, but let's put something about design concerns with boxy buildings, neighborhood compatibility.
That design. Karen, one more thing.
Yeah.
I brought up in the last session too, the town centers around the lake are very different in size and scale. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I'm most familiar with Tahoe City, which mm-hmm. is hamstrung with SCZ golf course and very, very limited expansion room. So these ideas of areas just outside the town centers that are currently not defined as town center, that's really important on North Shore to yeah. getting housing done. Kings Beach has a little more mm-hmm. of their grid included. Right. But Tahoe City has very little residential or multifamily residential. And I'd love to see that map of potential multifamily sites that you've showed for South Shore. I'd love to see the North Shore one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll write that down. So are you going to leave? Okay, thank you. And then I'll go.
Do we want to go over the density options again? I'll be right real quick.
Okay, thank you. So the two areas are again within town centers and in the vicinity of town centers. Within town centers, we'd like to look at just increasing density up to 40 units per acre at a minimum. Again, that's consistent with our tourist densities right now in these areas. Similarly, we would like to look at allowing California jurisdictions to implement the California bonus density law that has incentives for book density, obviously, but also height and parking. And last, we would like to consider a no density option that would essentially rely on other standards that would get at kind of the overall look and feel of the development and allow the developers or the developer to sort of decide how many units could fit inside depending on what is financially feasible. And then outside of town centers, again, we'd like to look at just increase in density to allow for those missing middle and affordable by design housing types. So allowing a triplex on all, or up to three units, a triplex on all lots that are already zoned for multifamily, or allowing up to 25 units per acre in areas, again, that are zoned already for multifamily housing. So our first question is, are there any components of the proposal that you particularly like? Or kind of in the same theme, is there any component that you dislike?
Belinda, I see your hand up.
Yes, thank you. And I mentioned this in one of the earlier sessions on coverage, And I just want to emphasize it here in this context as well. So if the rest of the group will bear with me, I just want to make sure it gets on this document as well. And that is that we should really promote and look at this issue very closely as it relates to transit corridors to ensure that those are given the highest priority. And if, you know, that means the potential for actually even at getting, you know, pushing that 40 unit limit. Again, you know, if that's possible, if that's something that that can help us meet our goals more quickly, I would, you know, frankly support looking at more density if it can get us there and it's appropriate to the setting and the other, you know, infrastructure that's necessary to support that. So I would just like to put that out there. And also outside of town centers to look at, you know, where are there opportunities to tie into, you know, planned transit corridors, greening. Here it's already mentioned, you know, walkable communities. How do we enhance that by making sure we have, you know, appropriate tree canopy and other amenities that are going to facilitate people, you know, walking to the town center from some of these, you know, locations to get some of the, you know, basic amenities that they need in order to, you know, support their lifestyle as local residents. So that would be my input there.
Thank you.
Great. So looking at kind of these higher density options in transit corridors, both existing and planned, and just kind of higher growth options in these transit walkshed areas.
I had a question. If it isn't currently zoned multifamily, but say it's on the highway, located on the state highway, so it meets a lot of criteria, but we don't have multifamily there already and we're built out, can we look at additional units? I mean, I support the concepts you raised, mm-hmm. but I, as you may be hearing, I'm going further to trying to find housing solutions because these have, we just aren't seeing movement in the area. So I'm interested in why just multifamily outside of town centers? Could we go to more density if they are located on the highway corridor? As Belinda said, that we have transit all the time on that highway corridor.
Right.
Yeah. We may just not have that zoning in that location.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad that you bring that up. Right now, that would, that would require a zoning change mm-hmm. To allow multifamily in those areas, which we haven't decided to take on through this process. But I think that's certainly worth noting that there are, you know, maybe areas that are appropriate. I'm thinking of like up in Placer that are right along the highway that aren't zoned for multifamily right now. We could also do a quick analysis of where those specific locations are and bring that back.
Or yeah. have that flexibility again for the jurisdiction to bring it back
yeah.
because we do know those areas maybe more than you can look at the basin-wide programs. I'm not saying allow it everywhere, but where it makes sense in a community that there's some flexibility because our town centers, now this is my third group saying, our town centers are very small on the North Shore and we don't have as much flexibility to locate housing right. and our crisis is arguably worse.
Right.
Yeah. So
any thoughts on, or yeah, John, go ahead. Well, I was going to ask any thoughts on, what the specific density should be. So we're talking about increasing densities in our town centers and outside of our town centers. A couple of the previous groups, that was a big focus of the conversation is what those densities should look like or should be. Curious if anyone has any ideas on that. And that's okay if they don't. Or yeah, why don't you go ahead?
The proposed densities seem reasonable to me. I don't have a necessary point of view on that, how much they should differ from that. I would definitely strongly support alignment with the California density bonus law. As you said, I made comment in a previous session. I realized should have been in this one, which was the, Tahoe Valley Town Center was somehow left out of the 100% affordable housing project pilot. discussion in the report. It's probably an oversight. Just want to put that in there. And then just like I've brought up in other context, anticipating concerns about more of everything, like what are the trade-offs? So what are the ways we could alleviate density elsewhere? So for example, TAUs for vacation rentals. I mean, if one impact of density is people and people equal impact in terms of, you know, VMT, etc., what are we doing to offset increased density elsewhere where it's not serving an affordable housing public benefit? And so in the analysis, just looking at opportunities to offset this impact, you know, this is serving a public purpose. There's other options, no doubt, too, that aren't serving much of a public benefit that could offset these impacts.
Definitely. Alexis, I'm curious if you have any thoughts specific to Washoe County that you would like to share.
Well, I was curious on why the working group arrived on that 40 units per acre in town centers. If you could provide any insight on that.
Yeah, so the 40 units per acre primarily came from the fact that we need to align our residential and tourist densities, because right now in town centers we're further incentivizing people to build tourist units over residential. So by going up to 40, we would essentially, remove that gap. But I think 40 again is what we would like to start at for this, and recognizing that residential densities in town centers could go above 40, because, you know, 40 units per acre on a smaller lot really is not that many units.
Right. Yeah. And I think that needs to be explored with, you know, obviously restrictions on what type of residential units those would be, you know, to ensure that their workforce are affordable. On if we can go, you know, have some additional density with that. So that's, I appreciate the information on that. And then on multifamily, I brought this up in a previous little breakout session, and I do think, like Cindy had stated, we need to look at zoning. And that's something that I need to be working with our team at Washoe on the area plan, and seeing what we have right now and what would be allowed, and kind of do some future planning when looking at zoning in our area plan. And I don't know if you can provide any context for me on if that work has been done. Do you know on the Washoe side?
I don't know off the top of my head. We can definitely circle back with you on that.
Okay. So I'm interested in what that looks like today, and then what we need to do for the future on that. Those are my perspectives. Did you have any specific concerns on those for Washoe that you wanted me to highlight?
Not necessarily, no. I think... you know, you bring a good perspective being in Nevada and representing Washoe County. So just wanted to get any input that you might have.
Thank you. And I think that I brought this up also in a former session, but if we could just speak to the differences in California state law versus Nevada state law, I don't necessarily think that these issues are going to be problems in Nevada state law, but it may be something, you know, that staff need to explore further as part of their analysis. And I'm happy to help you work with the DA's office if that's needed.
Yeah, we can definitely bring that back. Thank you.
And I see a top of a little head there, Alexis.
So I know, that's why I'm not there right now. Childcare is
get to see our face.
Yay! Yeah.
Hi!
Any other further comments, questions?
I just saw we got another public comment, somebody listening in, and I just want to state from my perspective, everything I've asked for and looking at more is not to say we earlier, John brought up a great comment. What are we avoiding? What are the environmental impacts that are decreasing once we keep people working, living in the basin that work here? We're not talking about new development for creating issues. This is all about workforce housing that is now driving and impacting our community. So as we look at that analysis, I share those concerns that this has got to be for workforce, and we have to see the offsets, whether it's density, coverage, or height, and the other environmental impacts being caused by people not being able to live and work in the basin. And so I just think whatever analysis we go through, making sure we keep that top of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point.
I think one of the offsets would be that by people being able to live in the basin, we're reducing vehicle miles traveled.
Oh, that's clearly the case. Absolutely. And there's others too. I was just sharing that our post office in Tahoe City has cut its hours to just being open to the public in the afternoons between 1 and 4. So if you're working, we don't have home mail delivery. So to go deal with anything at the post office, you have to take time off of work now or go during those working hours. I just got an email that our US Bank is saying drive up window only, no in person. I mean, whatever the crisis is here on South Shore, I guarantee you it's worse on North Shore right now. So
I'll tell you what.
And it's regular public services. It's not tourism. I mean, those are all impacted all and have been. But when you start hitting the postal service, law enforcement, water and sewer operations, parks maintenance, trash pickup, all the things that people care about. So
I walked into the Bank of America over in South Lake Tahoe the other day. Normally I don't go to the bank, but because everything's done electronically, there were two people in the building, two employees in the Bank of America. What?
Well, at least they had two. Our post office had zero.
On the Nevada side, we don't have home delivery. And
yeah, we don't even.
And it's very interesting to have your post office hours cut the way they are. I'm afraid we're going to lose our schools up here at the lake on the Douglas side.
No, I know we've lost a few members, so I'm just seeing we still have a quorum. So let's reconvene and.
Okay.
I know John had to leave and Belinda had to leave.
Jim did.
And Jim had to leave. Okay, so let's get back and we'll
do quick reports. I've been told by Karen and Alyssa that I'm first. So I will try to summarize while looking this way and speaking into the microphone. I'll try to speak out of both sides of my mouth.
Spoken like a politician.
I've never lived. Anyway, all three groups supported the concepts, everything that was there. There was some qualifications that they'd like to make sure that the concept of a stormwater system really working better than limiting coverage, that we have some science to prove that, and then we monitor that as we start implementing it. Wanted to clarify that the infrastructure we're talking about isn't just engineered systems with pipes that run into the lake, but systems that may have some engineering aspects, but then deal with water in a green way, like artificial wetlands, retention basins, detention basins, things like that. I think that's pretty much it on the support. Some of the ideas that people really liked or wanted to add was that as the percentage of coverage goes up, it's not just for if you're putting in a stormwater system, it's not just for deed restricted, because it makes sense if you're going to put in an area-wide system to capture the market rate housing there too. And so look at that, look at mixed market and deed restricted. Pointed out that we left out the Tahoe Valley Town Center. People also looked at some kind of additional, you know, all three groups had a hard time staying just with coverage. So they wanted to say, yes, you can have more coverage if it doesn't go to parking, if there's transit there, things like that. So that's probably it on that. Concern about maintenance, concerns about, let's see, displacement, concern about, well, one of the groups that really got into parking a lot was coverage can't become parking, and parking maximums and things like that. We got into a lot of parking stuff, which TRP hasn't got into, but also kind of there's a boundary on that, which is in this basin where we do have natural disasters like Caldor Fire, you have to make sure that there's at least enough transportation, maybe not public, to get people out. So we probably still want to have a place for one car per unit or something like that. I think those are the key points. I'm probably missing a little bit. So I'll ask anybody else if I missed anything on coverage. Or do we have the gist of where we want to go is a little bit bigger on the stormwater systems and sort of inclusion. But one other point was, if somebody wants to build a stormwater system outside of the town center, bring it on. It's not like likely that it makes sense financially, but why not? So kind of the concept is stormwater systems anywhere we have much development and key coverage elsewhere.
I
am disappointed that unlike development rights, we're not going to have a picture of you and Bill. Because it was in the slides earlier, but I noticed you two weren't looking. So.
I can report out next on the density groups. Agree with John that most of our groups or all of the groups didn't have any major concerns with any of the density options that we're proposing. There was some questions about how the no density option would work out, and some questions and concerns about how parking would be included in that. And so definitely when we're talking about pilot programs and a no density option, that we need to sort of look at how all of the development standards would play into that. And almost creating like a menu of incentives for developers to come in, and they can, you know, have certain things, but there would be trade-offs for open space or parking or what have you. A couple of comments. A few folks wanted us to look at the role of state conservancies with land donations. For the most part, they wanted us to apply these incentives to only deed restricted developments. And then a
few of the concerns. Let's see. We need to come up with incentives for all income levels. So some of these would be more appropriate, like the California density bonus law would be more appropriate for those lower income levels. So definitely focusing on the full range of affordable all the way up to achievable, and how do we kind of incentivize that whole range. Let's see. A couple of things that people wanted us to include in the analysis was the environmental impact of our workforce not actually living in Tahoe, which I think is a great point. One of the groups requested that we do an analysis to identify at what density does it pencil out and create a 12 to 15% return on investment for a developer, and that should be sort of that density that we end up with should sort of be our starting point for the density that we come back with. I think that sums up what I heard, but I welcome anyone else to chime in if I missed anything.
I just had a question. You said that all the groups agreed that density should only be granted for fully deed restricted projects, and going to what you had shared before and we've witnessed, should there be some market rate availability to make the projects pencil? Is that a tool
that
we need to consider, albeit minor, because you have to get to that 12 to 15% return?
Yeah, well, we have the Sugar Pine project as a prime example. 50% are market rate because that's how they made it pencil out, although that still gave us over 100 deed restricted units, which are great. That's how you balance. You do need some balance in some of this, at least at this point.
Yeah, and I will clarify that there were some comments, not necessarily all of the options should be specifically for deed restrictions, but the more, you know, the options like outside of town centers where we're allowing higher density for that smaller scale multifamily, that should be applied to deed restricted, but like larger multifamily that are getting that density bonus, those would need to have a market rate component in order to pencil out.
I think we really have to look at what actually is feasible, what gives you that kind of return, because we say we want it all to be deed restricted, but if 100% deed restricted isn't actually feasible, we won't get any. So we will have to look at that, and that's just one of the levers we have to pull. I mean, we want to see how to get the most deed restricted units, and then shape the other parameters around that density and coverage and parking and everything. So,
Shelley?
Looking at the Sugar Pine Village example, not all of these incentives were available to them. The incentive that made it pencil was the fact that they had market rate units integrated into the project. So, I mean, every one of these projects is going to require a certain amount of negotiation. And as Vince and I were talking earlier, you know, every site is a little bit unique, has different aspects to it, you know, in terms of topography, in terms of location. And so it really has to be, I think, these projects have to be considered on an individual basis. But I would just, if we're developing a menu of options, those are the options. And these are the incentives available. Which incentives do you need? You know, if they come back and say, well, none of the incentives are going to provide us with the rate of return that we're anticipating, that's when you come to them and say, okay, you can have X number of units that are market rate just to increase your, you know, your rate of return.
I was curious, how do you put that into regulations?
Oh, no, that's what we have staff.
or just, you know, curious. And I go back to a point system, right? Or I mean, I know that's probably not popular, but if you can somehow quantify it in some sort of a point system, because it will then take advantage of a lot of different circumstances around the base, and they're so unique. I mean, everybody that was in this room heard me say three times, our town center is too small to do anything in Tahoe City. We don't have enough area, so we have to be extremely flexible to get housing accomplished. And we don't have multifamily. We don't have much of a town center area.
Land prices are still, I think, probably the most formidable obstacle.
Absolutely.
I just want to piggyback on that, and I don't know where we put that in, but we were talking about using conservancy properties. You know, that's what the governor used, and that's how we get Sugar Pine, was we gave them free land off, so it was huge. We are looking at, in countywide, looking at our surplus properties similar to what the state's done, and so I don't know how you put that in there, but that's certainly an incentive that we should be using as any kind of government land, any kind of surplus land that's out there. How do we incorporate that, incentivize that into our regulations?
No. I think Vince was mentioning putting in an RFP. If you have a well-situated piece of property that's owned by a nonprofit, you know, then you put it out to bid. Here's the property. You know, here are the incentives, and you see who comes forward. And if they need additional incentives to make it pencil, if they can demonstrate that, then that's when you go to the option of allowing them to incorporate market rate housing.
I was just going
to... Haley had a point. She's been trying to get in here, John.
Sorry. And one thing, I just, our group, I really benefited from Vince having some developer perspective and Bill having been through this, that we talked about sort of how do you put this in code, right? There seems to have to be a balance between the flexibility all of us are asking for and giving developers a little bit of certainty, because one perspective that was shared is that if developers really have no idea what might be permitted or not, they may not take the gamble, they may not approach. And so having some parameters or menus or whatever it is, seems to be important so the developer community knows what they're getting into, knows what we're expecting, some parameters, but within there, it seems like flexibility for every site, be it the slope, how close you are to the lake, where you are, all these things matter, right? So we're not just setting sort of arbitrary numbers for everything. Was just, I thought, a good perspective that we need to find that middle.
Maybe it's in the process of hearings or whatever. We do that at a county level. We require pre-approval hearings now so that we can try to figure out where those nuances are before developers get too involved or put their hands up and walk away. I'm just curious how we do that. John.
Without beating a dead horse, because I think you guys are already there, is we've kind of got these in artificial silos, density, coverage, height, and really the point system. I've seen those where you have a bunch of different things, not just these three, but environmental benefit, etc. Bringing this all together so we create a package is something we didn't talk about, but a point system or some other way to do that is what Haley's talking about is exactly right. Mm-hmm. We'll have to do that.
Karen.
Okay, height. So I'm going to talk about group 2 and group 1 at the same time. So both of these groups talked about allowing significantly more flexibility for height in town centers. And we talked about some of the things that Haley talked about, like maybe we could, for certain sites, or, you know, go up to the tree canopy, or maybe not. At first we talked about maybe we shouldn't have any sort of height cap, but then these issues came up about we need certainty for developers. So we talked about using the tree canopy as something that we don't go over, and also really making sure that properties that are lakeside of the highway, that we would not allow the additional heights there. We talked about a potential max height of 90 feet, which would be about 7 stories in areas where it's appropriate, in town centers. And the group also mentioned not measuring from the lowest point on the parcel or on the project area, which we currently do. Instead, maybe looking at an average between the lowest and the highest point. Vince mentioned that pitched roofs. So when we started talking about reducing or removing the roof pitch requirements, Vince mentioned that pitched roofs are actually cheaper to build. So maybe we should look at increasing the height, but also allowing higher pitched roofs that might be cheaper while getting at additional space. Um, I can't read my lab. Outside of town centers, there are some. So there was some interest in additional height outside of town centers too, but they said there were some natural cutoffs, like you're not going to build an apartment building with an elevator probably outside of a town center, so you're unlikely to get buildings over a certain height. Oh, and then for group one, we had some ideas for looking in the environmental analysis to look at potentially tall buildings could also affect like a lack of light for trees. So that might be something that we should look at in the impact on soils and hydrology. So it's not just kind of the scenic impacts of the building. There may be other impacts that we need to consider as well. And there was some concern about boxy buildings, so making sure that the design is compatible with the neighborhood. And then in the other group, group three, just some encouragement to work with local jurisdictions on the design. If we're going to go from allowing any number of stories for making 56 feet be the cap, looking at sort of sound walls and designs, and that might be something that local jurisdictions do, but kind of encouraging them to look at that. And then people had some suggestions about some buildings in Brockway that had some very nice designs that allowed flatter roofs with dormers and some different kind of pitches. And that might be a good example to look at. So there's definitely some varieties in design. And so I would encourage, if there's something that I forgot, please feel free to chime in. But I think that mostly summarizes the input that we got.
There was a resistance in our group, though, to remove areas outside, mm-hmm. Outside town centers, to remove the restriction entirely.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. There's, you know, I keep coming up with exceptions, but I live in an area called Lake Forest. It's not a town center. Former commercial industrial area. It was the main highway route through North Shore. Mm-hmm. Yes, in my backyard. It should be higher and it should be more dense down there. It's walking distance to town. We may not get it in Tahoe City because of SEZ, but this is high capability developed land, full of old warehouses and former gas station sites and old restaurants. So mm-hmm. Ibaki is still there and it, yeah. So those are areas where it is circumstantial around the basin to say never outside of a town center. And yet here's an area that was commercially industrial. I mean, it's a lot of industrial down there. So how can we use that to help meet housing need? Yeah. And get a win-win. Good. Well, thank you so much. I think it was so helpful to be able to have smaller group discussion. I know we've run really late, but we do need to go to public comment unless there's other board member comments.
I just have one suggestion, sure. And I don't know who this person would be necessarily, but you know, if we could identify maybe a retired developer who has developed projects within the Tahoe Basin. As a consultant, either doing it on a pro bono basis or doing it, you know, for some sort of modest compensation, it would really be helpful for them before we, for example, to put together perhaps an RFP, as Vince suggested, to look at the economics of these deals, who has some practical experience with the, you know, with the density and height and other restrictions that are imposed by our current code, to give us a, you know, an idea of what will really be the most effective incentives to promote affordable housing development. Mm-hmm. You know, I think would be a valuable exercise.
That's great.
Will do. To do some of these things you're talking about, like get to a 15% ROI, we're going to have that kind of expertise.
Great. Okay, let's open this up for public comment now. If there's any member of the public who wishes to address the governing board on this agenda item, please raise your hand now, either in person or by clicking the raise hand button at the bottom of your Zoom screen or by dialing *9 on your phone to be unmuted. So we'll start first with any of you in the audience. Is there anybody? Come on up, Gavin. And sir, I don't know your name, but.
Good afternoon, board. It's nice to see you guys in person again, and a lot of new faces too, and a new chair. Congratulations. as you know, Gavin Feiger, on behalf of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, we've been the only environmental voice consistently at the table throughout the Tahoe Living Working Group. Very much appreciate working with the whole working group and staff and the board and APC. It's been going really well so far. I think density, height, you know, some of the low hanging fruit, found some good compromises on. Chatting with Jesse and Darcy this week. Coverage and development rights, of course, give us a heartburn. And I've said this every meeting for the last 2 years. But now that we're headed that direction and then starting to narrow in on those, we're interested in discussing coverage as long as we also discuss parking in a similar level of detail. Mm-hmm. I don't think that has come out from board direction yet, but based on the discussion today and looking at the walls and the easels here, hoping that this is a chance today to give that direction, that coverage and parking be looked at similarly. And with development rights, same kind of thing, not just looking at the residential units of use and the difference between, you know, a studio and a town center and a lakefront mansion, but looking at the effects of TAUs or short-term rentals as a residential use. Some of the conversions that have been happening, multifamily to airspace condo to short-term rental, some of the unintended consequences that we've seen come up from the development rights initiative, and looking a little more broadly at development rights than just residential units of use. So with those two things going forward, hopefully can help ease our heartburn a little bit, and looking forward to continue to be part of the team. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, Gavin. Sir, did you have any comments? I thought I saw your hand. Well, okay. Thank you. Okay, Maria, do we have anybody online?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have some comments or commenters. First, we have Ann Nichols. If you'd like to go ahead and address the board, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Ann.
Okay, thank you. Ann Nichols, North Tahoe Preservation Alliance. You know, this is just such a sea change that it's shocking. I went through all this with the regional plan update back in 2008, 2009, realtor for 50 years, sold commercial, built commercial. You know, this, another good idea was TRPA deciding that TAUs could be condos. And that's when all the trouble started. So the developers, wanting to make as much money as possible, decided to build condos, just like that 947 project, 40 units that was just approved on the consent calendar last month. No employee housing, no workforce housing, big, tall building, monolith. So, you know, this is about real estate values. It's not unique to Tahoe. But Tahoe at the same time is a unique spot. We are not a city. I mean, I know the frame of reference on South Shore is different about height and density and your infrastructure, but you've got to remember the North Shore. I really would like it if you guys would come up to the North Shore. We have a two-lane road from Sand Harbor to, you know, basically Tahoe City, and it can't be increased in size. Yet you're talking about a population increase that's radical, and there's not one mention about capacity and what can our infrastructure handle. 90 feet high. I mean, this is just 9 units instead of 2 units per lot. Or I guess actually said 10. I mean, this is shocking stuff. And everybody is shaking their head. Oh, yeah. So is this just another good idea, which is the more units, more density, more height, that's going to solve everything? Well, it hasn't for the last 15 years. Where is the evidence that this is going to work? And the reason it costs a lot to build here is because property values have gone through the roof. And then with code and building permit fees, all that, it's a lot of money. You're not addressing those issues. You're just doing the same thing you've always done. You're doubling down on a failed policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Next, we have Judith Miller.
you'd like to go ahead and address the committee or the board.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I'm a current resident of Incline Village, and I'm a former resident and motel owner in Tahoe City for many years. So I am very concerned about our critical shortage of workforce housing. And I think you have some good ideas for midterm and long-term improvements, but I find it very concerning that you're not looking at our existing housing stock, in particular short-term rentals, because these would be a potential near-term solution. Incline Village, unlike most of the other basin communities, was a planned development that is almost equally divided in single-family homes and condominiums. Nearly half of the 8,000 units are condos. The vast majority of short-term rentals are condos. I can't give you accurate numbers because it looks like the Washoe County GIS Open Data Warehouse no longer has short-term rental data, but nearly 1,000 SDRs are currently advertised in our community. And based on earlier data, I can estimate that at least 750 of them are condos. If a ban had been imposed or even just a limit set, we would still have many of these typically smaller and more affordable units available for our workforce. We already have so many vehicles in the basin, it would be disastrous in the event of a wildfire. Summer traffic has become a nightmare. Incline Crystal Bay has hundreds of additional tourist accommodations in the pipeline, which will only exacerbate these problems. More short-term rentals will make an already bad situation impossible and threaten the health and safety of visitors, residents, and last but not least, our precious lake. I know some of you already have CAPs, but I implore you as a regional planning agency to place a moratorium on STRs to increase workforce housing, at least until these life safety and transportation issues can be addressed. It will take several years to develop new housing units, and I applaud your efforts for that. But you can do something today to provide workforce housing as well as safeguard our communities. Please put a ban on STRs or a moratorium. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Next, we have Pamela. Go ahead and please address the board.
Hello, my name is Pamela Sigdinis. I'm a full-time resident of Incline Village in North Lake Tahoe. I ask respectfully that the TARPA board send this proposal back to staff for much needed research and analysis to address several critical overlooked issues that directly affect Nevada. First, Nevada property rights law differs dramatically from California. It's imperative that staff seek knowledgeable legal advice to determine what can actually be enforced in Nevada under current Nevada property rights laws. Second, the governing board and staff must address the elephant in the room. There will be no enforceable, affordable workforce housing program without actual compliance monitoring. Without proper monitoring, this well-intentioned program will be abused by developers and real estate investors seeking maximum return on investment. Please consider that there are already deed-restricted affordable housing units at Incline Village that have been usurped. These units have been sold and resold at fair market value. Third, TARPA must not greenlight more development into the Tahoe Basin without further restricting short-term rentals in northern Nevada. It's time for the TARPA board to reconsider its ill-informed 2004 decision to allow short-term rentals as permitted residential use. This decision has opened the door to real estate speculators, out-of-town property management companies, and other business interests to prioritize vacationers over full-time residents and local workers. There is currently no short-term rental limit in Incline Village Crystal Bay, and little to no compliance to hold non-permitted short-term rental operators accountable. Finally, TARPA cannot simply apply a cookie-cutter high-density approach to a workforce and affordable housing problem without acknowledging and addressing what Gavin and others have said. There is a distinct Tahoe environmental challenge, wildfire and extreme weather risks. There are problems with capacity already. We cannot manage what we currently have. More units will lead to more congestion, more abuse. Please direct staff to engage a developer who understands how to design an environmentally appropriate workforce housing project relevant to Tahoe communities. Please, please, as others have said, Judy, and we need more addressing of issues that are currently a problem in North Lake Tahoe, which have not been considered here. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, Pamela. Next.
Next, we have Toby Tyler. Toby, you can go ahead and address the board.
Yeah, Toby Tyler with the Sierra Club Tahoe Area Group. We need a larger conversation here about what is realistically sustainable for the basin. What it sounds like is being suggested is increasing development beyond a sustainable level and could very easily cause further deterioration of Tahoe's rural character. Although increasing density in urban areas is a laudable and sought-after goal to prevent or slow sprawl, using these density arguments here in these mountain areas around Lake Tahoe will not only further erode local trust in government, but would further deteriorate natural resources, scenic beauty, community well-being, and traffic concerns that are already at overcapacity. Regarding the BMPs, to mitigate this increased development, as one person noted, the BMPs that have been put in place to date are not maintained or monitored to determine effectiveness. So relying on these BMPs is not a plausible or appropriate mitigation strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Toby.
Madam Chair, we have no other hands raised to make public comment.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone, for your input. As I mentioned earlier, we'd received a number of letters on this item as well, and the board received all of those. So I appreciate that. Are there any further comments from the board before we close this item? We've worn you out. Okay. So then we'll move on to item number 9 on our agenda. These are reports, and I'm going to pass this over to Mr. Hester.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 4 items. One is, this is our first shot at trying to do a monthly report, like you talked about at your retreats. Gene McNamara on our staff has kind of moved from doing a quarterly report that's more about what we have done to try to generate the report you've asked for. So I know it's late in the day. If you have some input on this, just send it to me. We're always looking to improve it. We did find that, I think Ashley mentioned, try to forecast what's happening, and it's not as easy as we thought it would be, but we'll improve as time goes on. So, sure. 2 other kind of important things is, I just wanted to point out, I know you got an email on this, that Kat McIntyre on our staff is one of, I think, 47 people on National Wildfire Commission. So we're pretty proud of that. And then Dennis Zbaglo got an email on that, was also just appointed to a invasive species nationwide group. And then the last, but definitely not least, item, and I will pass these around so you're paying attention to this while John's talking on the legal counsel report. But with the new members, we have a number of changes that need to be made in the committees. So John and I, working with Cindy, put together this sheet that is for you to mark your preferences on which committees you'd like to be involved in. There is also the 2 working groups that one of them is, you just heard about, the Tahoe Living Working Group, and one of them is the Threshold Update Stakeholder Working Group, or TUI SWIG, as we affectionately call it. And then the last one is, you all may recall that you have a TTD board appointee, so that's on here too. We put down first, second, third, and fourth choice because we need some of you to take three or four committees to fill them up. The membership requirements are on there. The charters are attached. And we have, I didn't pass it out, but we have information on who's on what committees right now. So we will be working with Cindy to...
And Haley.
You get these to me, and then I will put the information together. And John Marshall, General Counsel, Chair and Vice Chair, and I will work together to get some new committee appointments to keep the committees full. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop talking because I know it's getting later in the day.
Thank you, John. And I do encourage us all to fill these forms out. We recently did this with another board I'm on, and we can't honor everybody's first choice in trying to make all the balances work for the various states and local governments and state appointments. But please fill this out, and we'll do our very best. And I roped Haley into this without her knowing when John said, we'll sit down and figure it out. I go, no, we've got to have Haley in and make sure we try to honor your requests and get everybody on committees they really find valuable. And we may have to ask you to serve on ones you're not as interested in to fill out the membership. So thank you very much.
I might add, if you'd rather not fill out a paper form and scan it and send it to me, just same email address, just tell me, send me the email with the
great
4 minute, and we can do that.
Thank you. And to our board members that have had to leave, or we'll send that to them as well.
Thank you.
Then we'll go to John Marshall for the general counsel report.
Just really briefly, we're filing briefs in two cases this week. The Eisenseken case, which is a challenge to the Ski Run cell tower. This case has been going on forever, and we just filed our motion to dismiss the third amended complaint together with this. They brought in the city of South Lake Tahoe, so they are filing a brief as well as Verizon. If you'd like to see all of these briefs, please let me know and I will send you copies. And then we're also filing this week a dispositive motion in the Bryan versus TRPA case. This case has to do with, you'll remember, the non-littoral buoy owner who brought an appeal after a denial. And so he's challenging TRPA's action of denying his request for a non-littoral buoy. And we filed the administrative record, and this is then the merits brief that hopefully will resolve the case.
Yes, Shelley.
John, are we using in-house counsel or outside counsel for these two?
For Brian, we're handling in-house, and for Eisenstecken, we're being funded by the
Verizon,
by the applicant.
Right.
So we're using outside counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Jones? Governing Board member reports. This is item 10 on our agenda. Are there any reports from board members? I'm not seeing any here. Okay. Then we'll go to committee reports, agenda item 11. Is there anything from any of the committees? We've gone over local government and housing today. So legal, operations and governance didn't meet. Transportation, public outreach, public, or forest health and wildfire, or the ARPIC?
I'm sure.
Yes.
Our ad hoc committee is not a standing committee, but I did fail to mention that during our conversation with Steve Worthington, with Prothman, I'd like everybody to check their calendars, just to check on their availability on November 3rd, because they were anticipating the possibility of a special meeting following the week. For the final selection versus a decision after the debriefing. So we need to reserve that in the event they elect to continue it into November. So if you could check that date, November 3rd, that would be great.
Thank you, Shelley. Okay. Then moving on, we'll go to our final public comment period. If there's any member of the public wishing to address the governing board on any item listed or not listed on the agenda, including items on the consent calendar, you may do so at this time. Individuals or groups who have already commented are not permitted to comment again on the same topic, and the governing board is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing items raised by the public during this public comment period. So I'll open it up now to those in the room. Yes, sir. And then we'll go to those online.
Thank you. I didn't need to hear that anyway. I'm Steve Dolan, and I'm the director of Friends of Third Creek. And this is not on your agenda, but I feel like at the moment it's very important because we've been monitoring the U.S. Forest Service for the past many years, but in particular the past 3 years, where they've been removing the Incline Lake Dam. And in that process, they have violated so many rules regarding best management practices and management of the environment and the fish up there, that I thought I should let you know of this upcoming event. That's what the paper is basically alluding to. 3 years ago, when I approached the TRPA about violations going on up there, I was told that TRPA has an MOU with LTBMU, Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit of the U.S. Forest Service, and that nothing could be done by TRPA regarding managing the U.S. Forest Service. They arrived. I like the U.S. Forest Service. They do a lot of good things, but their contractors aren't managed properly. And they arrived, ripped out from the route 400 trees without a single fence or wattle to filter the water running off of from the rains, running off from the site up there. They also had no dust mitigation. Well, the first confrontation I had with them, they put in the fencing and then the wattles. They never did dust mitigation with 8 inches of dust that covered a square mile of the Incline Third Creek area up there. Last year, they decided to do that with some dust mitigation. And their solution was to pump the water from the artesian springs that have remained after the emptying of the lake, which is illegal, which the Nevada Department of Wildlife is very upset about, wrote letters to them. This year, that was all just to work on the dam. This year, they're going to redo the meadow that has been evolving in the 5 years since the draining of the lake. That meadow has chosen its path. It's doing beautifully. It's gorgeous. And they don't seem to understand that downstream last year, when they diverted the water for the springs from the springs to do dust mitigation and water their planting, they could have blotted in, but they didn't. They killed the stream below the old dam. Literally dried up the marshes, the ponds, and the stream for a mile downstream. I have submitted pictures to the TRPA. Many have been viewed. I've made a lot of complaints. I've got videos showing this dust. I've got videos showing the dried creek. And now, because of the last winter's big rainstorm, which refilled the water that had been sucked out of the meadow and refilled the stream below the meadow to the point where the confluence is of both of Third Creek's wings there, is where this beaver's pond is. And because it got flushed out and filled up, a beaver migrated there just recently. And this project of theirs to change the meadow is about to begin again. And besides Friends of Third Creek monitoring them, it would be great. And I heard the term compliance monitoring being important. I see that as an important thing for TRPA to do with the U.S. Forest Service, especially around Third Creek, which is an incredibly special creek on the lake. You've read there some of the things that make it very, very special. It's the only registered Lahontan cutthroat trout stream on the lake. It's the most genetically diverse stream on the lake. The Nevada Department of Wildlife Fisheries has been studying the spawning habits in that creek. There are 8 different types of fish that spawn from April through December in that creek. And the Washoe tribe has made it, through their records, the only creek on the lake that is a registered habitat for the Lahontan cutthroat trout, which U.S. Forest Service and Nevada are coming together to try and reestablish it that way. So there are good things happening. But I think that with regards to this creek, all the way up to the summit, there are things going on with the U.S. Forest Service that TRPA really needs to monitor. I'm sorry if I'm taking too much time.
Yeah, I was just going to call. We didn't get our timer set, but you're just...
Thank you.
We need
to... I appreciate it. The last thing is that the Forest Service has a machine proposal, you know, snowmobile proposal. And Third Creek is now the dividing line between the wilderness and the forest. So we need to try and influence them to keep this riparian zone and... Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Nolan. Appreciate you being here all day, too. Mari, is there anybody online?
Madam Chair, there is no hands raised to make public comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then we're going to close the public comment, and I would ask for a motion to adjourn today. Absolutely. I have a motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay.